Is there a wall?
She asked the man selling fruit, speaking with her own voice.
To keep the bad things out, he replied.
What bad things?
Very bad things. There is a wall. Do not go beyond it, or you shall die.
The fruit seller picked up his cart and moved away. And still the girl looked up at the wall. Pattern hovered beside her and hummed happily to himself.
Why is there a wall?
She asked the woman, suckling her child. The woman had Polona's face.
To protect us, the woman said. To protect us from what?
Very bad things. There is a wall. Do not go beyond it, or you shall die.
The woman took her child and left. The girl climbed a tree, peeking out the top, her scarf streaming behind her.
Why is there a wall?
She called to the boy sleeping lazily in the nook of a branch.
What wall?
The boy asked. The girl thrust her finger pointedly toward the wall.
That's not a wall, the boy said, drowsy.
Shallan had given him the face of one of the bridgemen, a Herdazian.
That's just the way the sky is over there.
It's a wall, the girl said. A giant wall.
It must be there for a purpose, the boy said. Yes, it is a wall. Don't go beyond it, or you'll probably die.
Well,
Shallan continued, speaking from the audience.
These answers did not satisfy the girl who looked up. She reasoned to herself, if the wall kept evil things out, then the space on this side of it should be safe. So one night, while the others of the village slept, she sneaked from her home with a bundle of supplies. She walked toward the wall, and indeed the land was safe. But it was also dark, always in the shadow of that wall. No sunlight ever directly reached the people.
Shallan made the illusion roll like scenery on a scroll as the players had used, only far, far more realistic. She had painted the ceiling with light, and looking up, you seemed to be looking only at an infinite sky, dominated by that wall.
This is far more extensive than I've done before, she thought, surprised.
Creation Spren had started to appear around her on the benches, in the form of old latches or doorknobs, rolling about or moving end over end.
Well, Dalinar had told her to practice.
The girl traveled far, Shallan said, looking back toward the stage. No predators hunted her, and no storms assaulted her. The only wind was the pleasant one that played with her scarf, and the only creatures she saw were the kremlings that clicked at her as she walked. At long last, the girl in the scarves stood before the wall. It was truly expansive, running as far as she could see in either direction, and its height! It reached almost to the tranquiline halls. Shallan stood and walked onto the stage, passing into a different land, an image of fertility, vines, trees, and grass, dominated by that terrible wall. It grew spikes from its front in bristling patches.
I didn't draw this scene out. At least, not recently.
She'd drawn it as a youth, in detail, putting her imagined fancies down on paper.
What happened? Pattern said. Shallan, I must know what happened. Did she turn back?
Of course she didn't turn back, Shallan said.
She climbed.
There were outcroppings in the wall, things like these spikes or hunched, ugly statues. She had climbed the highest trees all through her youth. She could do this.
The girl started climbing. Had her hair been white when she'd started?
Shallan frowned. Shallan made the base of the wall sink into the stage, so although the girl got higher, she remained chest-height to Shallan and Pattern.
The climb took days, Shallan said, hand to her head. At night, the girl who looked up would tie herself a hammock out of her scarf and sleep there. She picked out her village at one point, remarking on how small it seemed, now that she was high. As she neared the top, she finally began to fear what she would find on the other side. Unfortunately, this fear did not stop her. She was young,
and questions bothered her more than fear. So it was that she finally struggled to the very top and stood to see the other side, the hidden side. Shallan choked up. She remembered sitting at the edge of her seat, listening to this story. As a child, when moments like watching the players had been the only bright spots in life. Too many memories of her father, and of her mother, who had loved telling her stories. She tried to banish those memories, but they wouldn't go. Shallan turned. Her stormlight. She'd used up almost everything she'd pulled from her satchel. Out in the seats, a crowd of dark figures watched. Eyeless, just shadows. People from her memories. The outline of her father, her mother, her brothers, and a dozen others. She couldn't create them because she hadn't drawn them properly. Not since she'd lost her collection. Next to Shallan, the girl stood triumphantly on the wall's top, her scarves and white hair streaming out behind her in a sudden wind. Pattern buzzed beside Shallan.
"And on that side of the wall," Shallan whispered, "the girl saw steps."
The backside of the wall was crisscrossed with enormous sets of steps leading down to the ground, so distant.
"What? What does it mean?" Pattern said.
"The girl stared at those steps," Shallan whispered, remembering.
And suddenly the gruesome statues on her side of the wall made sense. The spears. The way it cast everything into shadow. The wall did indeed hide something evil. Something frightening. It was the people. Like the girl and her village.
The illusion started to break down around her.
This was too ambitious for her to hold, and it left her strained, exhausted, her head starting to pound. She let the wall fade, claiming its stormlight. The landscape vanished, then finally the girl herself. Behind, the shadowed figures in the seats started to evaporate. Stormlight streamed back to Shallan, stoking the storm inside.
"That's how it ended?" Pattern asked.
"No," Shallan said, stormlight puffing from her lips. "She goes down, sees a perfect society lit by stormlight. She steals some and brings it back. The storms come as a punishment, tearing down the wall."
"Ah," Pattern said, hovering beside her on the now dull stage. "So that's how the storms first began?"
"Of course not," Shallan said, feeling tired. "It's a lie, Pattern. A story. It doesn't mean anything."
"Then why are you crying?"
She wiped her eyes and turned away from the empty stage. She needed to get back to the markets. In the seats, the last of the shadowy audience members puffed away. All but one, who stood up and walked out the back doors of the theater. Startled, Shallan felt a sudden shock run through her. That figure hadn't been one of her illusions. She flung herself from the stage, landing hard, Vale's coat fluttering, and dashed after the figure. She held the rest of her stormlight, a thrumming, violent tempest. She skidded into the hall outside, glad for sturdy boots and simple trousers. Something shadowy moved down the corridor. Shallan gave chase, lips drawn to a sneer, letting stormlight rise from her skin and illuminate her surroundings. As she ran, she pulled a string from her pocket and tied her hair back, becoming radiant. Radiant would know what to do if she caught this person. Can a person look that much like a shadow? "Pattern!" she shouted, thrusting her right hand forward. Luminescent fog formed there, becoming her shard blade. Light escaped her lips, transforming her more fully into radiant. Luminescent wisps trailed behind her, and she felt it chasing her. She charged into a small round chamber and skidded to a stop. A dozen versions of herself, from drawings she'd done recently, split around her and dashed through the room. Shallan in her dress, veil in her coat. Shallan is a child. Shallan is a youth. Shallan is a soldier, a happy wife, a mother. Leaner here, plumper there, scarred, bright with excitement, bloodied and in pain. They vanished after passing her, collapsing one after another into stormlight that curled and twisted about itself, before vanishing away. Radiant raised her shard blade in the stance Adolin had been teaching her, sweat dripping down the sides of her face. The room would have been dark, but for the light curling off her skin and passing through her clothing to rise around her. Empty. She'd either lost her quarry in the corridors, or it had been a spren and not a person at all. Or there was nothing there in the first place, a part of her worried. Your mind is not trustworthy these days.
What was that? Radiant said. Did you see it?
No, Pattern thought to her. I was thinking on the lie. She walked around the edge of the circular room. The wall was scored by a series of deep slots that ran from floor to ceiling. She could feel air moving through them. What was the purpose of a room like this? Had the people who designed this place been mad? Radiant noted faint light coming from several of the slots, and with it the sounds of people in a low, echoing clatter. The breakaway market? Yes. She was in that region, and while she was on the third level, the market's cavern was a full 4 stories high. She moved to the next slot and peered through it, trying to decide just where it let out. Was this... Something moved in the slot. A dark mass wriggled deep inside, squeezing between walls, like goo but with bits jutting out. Those were elbows, ribs, fingers splayed along one wall, each knuckle bending backward. A spren, she thought, trembling. It is some strange kind of spren. The thing twisted, head deforming in the tiny confines, and looked toward her. She saw eyes reflecting her light, twin spheres set in a mashed head, a distorted human visage. Radiant pulled back with a sharp gasp, summoning her shard blade again and holding it wardingly before herself. But what was she going to do? Hack her way through the stone to get to the thing? That would take forever. Did she even want to reach it? No, but she had to anyway. The market, she thought, dismissing her blade and darting back the way she'd come. It's heading to the market. With stormlight propelling her, Radiant dashed through corridors, barely noticing as she breathed out enough to transform her face into veils. She swerved through a network of twisted passages. This maze, these enigmatic tunnels, were not what she'd expected from the home of the Knights Radiant. Shouldn't this be a fortress, simple but grand, a beacon of light and strength in the dark times? Instead, it was a puzzle. Vale stumbled out of the back corridors into populated ones, then dashed past a group of children laughing and holding up chips for light and making shadows on the walls. Another few turns took her out onto the balcony walk around the cavernous breakaway market, with its bobbing lights and busy pathways. Vale turned left to see slots in the wall here. For ventilation? The thing had come through one of these, but where had it gone after that? A scream rose, shrill and cold from the floor of the market below. Cursing to herself, Vale took the steps at a reckless pace, just like Vale, running headlong into danger. She sucked in her breath, and the stormlight puffing around her pulled in, causing her to stop glowing. After a short dash, she found people gathering between 2 packed rows of tents. The stalls here sold various goods, many of which looked to be salvage from the more abandoned war camps. More than a few enterprising merchants, with the tacit approval of their high princes, had sent expeditions back to gather what they could. With stormlight flowing and Renarin to help with the Oath Gate, those had finally been allowed into Urethiru. The high princes had gotten first pick. The rest of their finds were heaped in the tents here, watched over by guards with long cudgels and short tempers. Vale shoved her way to the front of the crowd, finding a large horn-eater man cursing and holding his hand. Rock, she thought, recognizing the bridgeman, though he wasn't in uniform. His hand was bleeding. Like it was stabbed right through the center, Vale thought. What happened here? She demanded, still holding her light in to keep it from puffing out and revealing her. Rock eyed her, while his companion, a bridgeman she thought she'd seen before, rapped his hand.
Who are you to ask me this thing?
Storms. She was Vale right now, but she didn't dare expose the ruse, especially not in the open.
I'm on Aladar's policing force, she said, digging in her pocket. I have my commission here. It's fine, Rock said, sighing, his wariness seeming to evaporate. I did nothing. Some person pulled knife. I did not see him well. Long coat and a hat. A woman in crowd screamed, drawing my attention. Then this man, he attacked.
Storms, who is dead?
Dead? The horn-eater looked to his companion. Nobody is dead. Attacker stabbed my hand, then ran. Was assassination attempt, maybe? Person got angry about rule of tower, so he attacked me for being in Colin Guard?
Vale felt a chill. Horn-eater. Tall. Burly. The attacker had chosen a man who looked very similar to the one she had stabbed the other day. In fact, they weren't far from All's Alley, just a few streets over in the market. The two bridgemen turned to leave, and Vale let them go. What more could she learn? The horn-eater had been targeted not because of anything he'd done, but because of how he looked. And the attacker had been wearing a coat and hat, like Vale usually did.
I thought I'd find you here.
Vale started, then whirled around, hand going to her belt knife. The speaker was a woman in a brown hava. She had straight Alethi hair, dark brown eyes, bright red painted lips, and sharp black eyebrows almost certainly enhanced with makeup. Vale recognized this woman, who was shorter than she'd seemed while sitting down. She was one of the thieves that Vale had approached at All's Alley, the one whose eyes had lit up when Shallan had drawn the Ghost Blood's symbol.
What did he do to you? The woman asked, nodding toward Rock. Or do you just have a thing for stabbing horn-eaters?
This wasn't me, Vale said.
I'm sure.
The woman stepped closer.
I've been waiting for you to turn up again.
You should stay away, if you value your life.
Vale started off through the market. The short woman scrambled after her.
My name is Ishna. I'm an excellent writer. I can take dictations. I have experience moving in the market underground.
You want to be my ward?
Ward?
The young woman laughed.
What are we? Light eyes? I want to join you.
The Ghost Bloods, of course. We're not recruiting.
Please.
She took Vale by the arm.
Please. The world is wrong now. Nothing makes sense. But you, your group, you know things. I don't want to be blind anymore.
Shallan hesitated. She could understand that desire to do something, rather than just feeling the world tremble and shake. But the Ghost Bloods were despicable. This woman would not find what she desired among them, and if she did, then she was not the sort of person that Shallan would want to add to Moraes's quiver.
No, Shallan said. Do the smart thing, and forget about me and my organization.
She pulled out of the woman's grip and hurried away through the bustling market.
26. Blackthorn Unleashed. 29 years ago. Incense burned in a brazier as large as a boulder. Dalinar sniffled as Evie threw a handful of tiny papers, each folded and inscribed with a very small glyph, into the brazier. Fragrant smoke washed over him, then whipped in the other direction as winds ripped through the war camp, carrying windspren like lines of light. Evie bowed her head before the brazier. She had strange beliefs, his betrothed. Among her people, simple glyph words weren't enough for prayers. You needed to burn something more pungent. While she spoke of Yezereza and Kalek, she said their names strangely, Yesi and Kelai, and she made no mention of the Almighty. Instead, she spoke of something called the One, a heretical tradition the Ardents told him came from Eerie. Dalinar bowed his head for a prayer. Let me be stronger than those who would kill me. Simple and to the point, the kind he figured the Almighty would prefer. He didn't feel like having Evie write it out.
The One watch you, near husband, Evie murmured, and soften your temper.
Her accent, to which he was now accustomed, was thicker than her brother's. Soften it? Evie, that's not the point of battle.
You needn't kill in anger, Dalinar. If you must fight, do it knowing that each death wounds the One, for we are all people in Yesi's sight.
Yeah, all right, Dalinar said. The Ardents didn't seem to mind that he was marrying someone half-pagan. It is wisdom to bring her to Vorin Truth, Yavenna, Gavilar's head Ardent, had told him, similar to how she'd spoken of his conquest.
Your sword will bring strength and glory to the Almighty.
Idly, he wondered what it would take to actually earn the Ardent's displeasure.
Be a man, and not a beast, Dalinar, Evie said,
then pulled close to him, setting her head on his shoulder and encouraging him to wrap his arms around her. He did so with a limp gesture. Storms, he could hear the soldiers snicker as they passed by. The Blackthorn being consoled before battle, publicly hugging and acting lovey? Evie turned her head toward him for a kiss, and he presented a chaste one, their lips barely touching. She accepted that, smiling. And she did have a beautiful smile. Life would have been a lot easier for him if Evie would have just been willing to move along with the marriage. But her traditions demanded a long engagement, and her brother kept trying to get new provisions into the contract. Dalinar stomped away. In his pocket he held another glyph ward, one provided by Navani, who obviously worried about the accuracy of Evie's foreign script. He felt at the smooth paper and didn't burn the prayer. The stone ground beneath his feet was pocked with tiny holes, the pinpricks of hiding grass. As he passed the tents, he could see it properly covering the plain outside, waving in the wind. Tall stuff, almost as high as his waist. He'd never seen grass that tall in Kolin lands. Across the plain, an impressive force gathered, an army larger than any they'd faced. His heart jumped in anticipation. After 2 years of political maneuvering, here they were, a real battle with a real army. Win or lose, this was the fight for the kingdom. The sun was on its way up, and the armies had arrayed themselves north and south so neither would have it in their eyes. Dalinar hastened to his armorer's tent and emerged a short time later in his plate. He climbed carefully into the saddle as one of the grooms brought his horse. The large black beast wasn't fast, but it could carry a man in shard plate. Dalinar guided the horse past ranks of soldiers, spearmen, archers, light-eyed heavy infantry, even a nice group of 50 cavalrymen under Illimar, with hooks and ropes for attacking shard-bearers. Anticipation spren waved like banners among them all. Dalinar still smelled incense when he found his brother, geared up and mounted, patrolling the front lines. Dalinar trotted up beside Gavilar.
Your young friend didn't show for the battle, Gavilar noted.
Sabariel, Dalinar said. He's not my friend.
There's a hole in the enemy line still waiting for him, Gavilar said, pointing. Reports say he had a problem with his supply lines. Lies. He's a coward. If he'd arrived, he'd have had to actually pick a side. They rode past Tirum, Gavilar's captain of the guard, who wore Dalinar's extra plate for this battle. Technically, that still belonged to Evie. Not Toe, but Evie herself, which was strange. What would a woman do with shard plate? Give it to a husband, apparently. Tirum saluted. He was capable with shards, having trained, as did many aspiring light eyes with borrowed sets. "You've done well, Dalinar," Gavilar said as they rode past. "That plate will serve us today." Dalinar made no reply. Even though Evie and her brother had delayed such a painfully long time to even agree to the betrothal, Dalinar had done his duty. He just wished he felt more for the woman. Some passion. Some true emotion. He couldn't laugh without her seeming confused by the conversation. He couldn't boast without her being disappointed in his bloodlust. She always wanted him to hold her, as if being alone for one storming minute would make her wither and blow away. And, "Ho!" one of the scouts called from a wooden mobile tower. She pointed, her voice distant.
"Ho there!"
Dalinar turned, expecting an advance attack from the enemy. But no, Kalinor's army was still deploying. It wasn't men that had attracted the scouts' attention, but horses. A small herd of them, 11 or 12 in number, galloping across the battlefield. Proud. Majestic. "Rashadium," Gavilar whispered. "It's rare they roam this far east." Dalinar swallowed in order to round up the beasts. "Rashadium?" Yes, he could see the spren trailing after them in the air. Music spren, for some reason. Made no storming sense. Well, no use trying to capture the beasts. They couldn't be held unless they chose a rider. "I want you to do something for me today, brother," Gavilar said. "High Prince Kalinor himself needs to fall. As long as he lives, there will be resistance. If he dies, his line goes with him. His cousin, Loredar Vama, can seize power. Will Loredar swear to you?" "I'm certain of it," Gavilar said. "Then I'll find Kalinor," Dalinar said, "and end this." "He won't join the battle easily, knowing him. But he's a shard-bearer, and so..." "So we need to force him to engage." Gavilar smiled. "What?" Dalinar said. "I'm simply pleased to see you talking of tactics." "I'm not an idiot," Dalinar growled. He always paid attention to the tactics of a battle. He simply wasn't one for endless meetings and jaw-wagging. Though, even those seemed more tolerable these days. Perhaps it was familiarity. Or maybe it was Gavilar's talk of forging a dynasty. It was the increasingly obvious truth that this campaign, now stretching over many years, was no quick bash and grab. "Bring me Kalinor, brother," Gavilar said. "We need the Blackthorn today." "All you need do is unleash him." "Ha! As if anyone existed who could leash him in the first place." "Isn't that what you've been trying to do?" Dalinar thought immediately. "Marrying me off, talking about how we have to be civilized now, highlighting everything I do wrong as the things we must expunge." He bit his tongue, and they finished their ride down the lines. They parted with a nod, and Dalinar rode over to join his elites.
"Orders, sir?" asked Rian.
"Stay out of my way," Dalinar said, lowering his faceplate. The shardplate helm sealed closed, and a hush fell over the elites. Dalinar summoned Oathbringer, the sword of a fallen king, and waited. The enemy had come to stop Gavilar's continued pillage of the countryside. They would have to make the first move. These last few months, spent attacking isolated, unprotected towns, had made for unfulfilling battles, but it also put Kalinor in a terrible position. If he sat back in his strongholds, he allowed more of his vassals to be destroyed. Already those started to wonder why they paid Kalinor taxes.
A handful had preemptively sent messengers to Gavilar, saying they would not resist. The region was on the brink of flipping to the Colins, and so High Prince Kalanor had been forced to leave his fortifications to engage here. Dalinar shifted on his horse, waiting, planning. The moment came soon enough. Kalanor's forces started across the plain in a cautious wave, shields raised toward the sky. Gavilar's archers released flights of arrows. Kalanor's men were well trained. They maintained their formations beneath the deadly hail. Eventually, they met Colin heavy infantry, a block of men so armored that it might as well have been solid stone. At the same time, mobile archer units sprang out to the sides. Lightly armored, they were fast. If the Colins won this battle, and Dalinar was confident they would, it would be because of the newer battlefield tactics they'd been exploring. The enemy army found itself flanked, arrows pounding the sides of their assault blocks. Their lines stretched, the infantry trying to reach the archers, but that weakened the central block, which suffered a beating from the heavy infantry. Standard spearmen blocks engaged enemy units as much to position them as to do them harm. This all happened on the scale of the battlefield. Dalinar had to climb off his horse and send for a groom to walk the animal as he waited. Inside, Dalinar fought back the thrill, which urged him to ride in immediately. Eventually, he picked a section of Colin troops who were faring poorly against the enemy block. Good enough. He remounted and kicked his horse into a gallop. This was the right moment. He could feel it. He needed to strike now, when the battle was pivoting between victory and loss, to draw out his enemy. Grass wriggled and pulled back in a wave before him, like subjects bowing. This might be the end, his final battle in the conquest of Alethkar. What happened to him after this? Endless feasts with politicians? A brother who refused to look elsewhere for battle? Dalinar opened himself to the thrill and drove away such worries. He struck the line of enemy troops like a high storm hitting a stack of papers. Soldiers scattered before him, shouting. Dalinar laid about with his shard blade, killing dozens on one side, then the other. Eyes burned, arms fell limp. Dalinar breathed in the joy of the conquest, the narcotic beauty of destruction. None could stand before him. All were tinder, and he the flame. The soldier block should have been able to band together and rush him, but they were too frightened. And why shouldn't they be? People spoke of common men bringing down a shard-bearer, but surely that was a fabrication, a conceit intended to make men fight back, to save shard-bearers from having to hunt them down. He grinned as his horse stumbled, trying to cross the bodies piling around it. Dalinar kicked the beast forward, and it leaped, but as it landed, something gave. The creature screamed and collapsed, dumping him. He sighed, shoving aside the horse and standing. He'd broken its back. Shardplate was not meant for such common beasts. One group of soldiers tried a counterattack. Brave, but stupid. Dalinar felled them with broad sweeps of his shard blade. Next, a light-eyed officer organized his men to come press and try to trap Dalinar, if not with their skill, then their weight of bodies. He spun among them, plate lending him energy, blade granting him precision, and the thrill giving him purpose. In moments like this, he could see why he had been created. He was wasted listening to men blab. He was wasted doing anything but this, providing the ultimate test of men's abilities, proving them, demanding their lives at the edge of a sword. He sent them to the Tranquiline Halls primed and ready to fight. He was not a man. He was judgment. Enthralled, he cut down foe after foe, sensing a strange rhythm to the fighting, as if the blows of his sword needed to fall to the dictates of some unseen beat. A redness grew at the edges of his vision, eventually covering the landscape like a veil. It seemed to shift and move like the coils of an eel, trembling to the beats of his sword. He was furious when a calling voice distracted him from the fight.
Dalinar!
He ignored it.
Bright Lord Dalinar! Blackthorn!
That voice was like a screeching Kremlin, playing its song inside his helm. He felled a pair of swordsmen. They'd been light-eyed, but their eyes had burned away, and you could no longer tell.
Blackthorn!
Bah! Dalinar spun toward the sound. A man stood nearby, wearing Colin blue. Dalinar raised his shard blade. The man backed away, raising hands with no weapon, still shouting Dalinar's name.
I know him. He's... Kadash?
One of the captains among his elites. Dalinar lowered his sword and shook his head, trying to get the buzzing sound out of his ears. Only then did he see, really see, what surrounded him. The dead. Hundreds upon hundreds of them, with shriveled coals for eyes, their armor and weapons sheared, but their bodies eerily untouched. Almighty above, how many had he killed? He raised his hand to his helm, turning and looking about him. Timid blades of grass crept up among the bodies, pushing between arms, fingers, beside heads. He'd blanketed the plain so thoroughly with corpses that the grass had a difficult time finding places to rise. Dalinar grinned in satisfaction, then grew chill. A few of those bodies with burned eyes, three men he could spot, wore blue. His own men, bearing the armband of the elites.
"Bright Lord," Kadash said. "Blackthorn, your task is accomplished."
He pointed toward a troop of horsemen charging across the plain. They carried the silver-on-red flag bearing a glyph pair of two mountains. Left no choice, High Prince Kalinor had committed to the battle. Dalinar had destroyed several companies on his own. Only another shard-bearer could stop him.
"Excellent," Dalinar said.
He pulled off his helm and took a cloth from Kadash, using it to wipe his face. A water skin followed. Dalinar drank the entire thing. Dalinar tossed away the empty skin, his heart racing, the thrill thrumming within.
"Pull back the elites. Do not engage unless I fall."
Dalinar pulled his helm back on and felt the comforting tightness as the latches cinched into place.
"Yes, Bright Lord. Gather those of us who... fell," Dalinar said, waving toward the Colin dead. "Make certain they and theirs are cared for."
"Of course, sir."
Dalinar dashed toward the oncoming force, his shard plate crunching against stones. He felt sad to have to engage a shard-bearer instead of continuing his fight against the ordinary men. No more laying waste. He now had only one man to kill. He could vaguely remember a time when facing lesser challenges hadn't sated him as much as a good fight against someone capable. What had changed? His run took him toward one of the rock formations on the eastern side of the field, a group of enormous spires, weathered and jagged, like a row of stone stakes. As he entered the shadows, he could hear fighting from the other side. Portions of the armies had broken off and tried to flank each other by rounding the formations. At their base, Kalinor's honor guards split, revealing the High Prince himself on horseback. His plate was overlaid with a silver coloring, perhaps steel or silver leaf. Dalinar had ordered his plate buffed back to its normal slate gray. He'd never understood why people would want to augment the natural majesty of shardplate. Kalinor's horse was a tall, majestic animal, brilliant white with a long mane. It carried the shard-bearer with ease, a Rashadium. Yet Kalinor dismounted. He patted the animal fondly on the neck, then stepped forward to meet Dalinar, shard-blade appearing in his hand.
"Blackthorn," he called. "I hear you've been single-handedly destroying my army. They fight for the Tranquiline Halls now. Would that you had joined to lead them."
"Someday," Dalinar said. "When I am too old and weak to fight here, I'll welcome being sent."
"Curious how quickly tyrants grow religious. It must be convenient to tell yourself that your murders belong to the Almighty instead."
"They'd better not belong to him," Dalinar said. "I worked hard for those kills, Kalinor. The Almighty can't have them. He can merely credit them to me when weighing my soul."
Then let them weigh you down to damnation itself.
Kalanor waved back his honor guard, who seemed eager to throw themselves at Dalinar. Alas, the High Prince was determined to fight on his own. He swiped with his sword, a long, thin shard blade with a large crossguard and glyphs down its length.
If I kill you, Blackthorn, what then?
Then Sadeus gets a crack at you.
No honor on this battlefield, I see.
Oh, don't pretend you are any better, Dalinar said. I know what you did to rise to your throne. You can't pretend to be a peacemaker now.
Considering what you did to the peacemakers, Kalanor said, I'll count myself lucky.
Dalinar leaped forward, falling into blood stance, a stance for someone who didn't care if he got hit. He was younger, more agile than his opponent. He counted on being able to swing faster, harder. Strangely, Kalanor chose blood stance himself. The two clashed, bashing their swords against one another in a pattern that sent them twisting about in a quick shuffle of footings, each trying to hit the same section of plate repeatedly to open a hole to flesh. Dalinar grunted, batting away his opponent's shard blade. Kalanor was old, but skilled. He had an uncanny ability to pull back before Dalinar's strikes, deflecting some of the force of the impact, preventing the metal from breaking. After furiously exchanging blows for several minutes, both men stepped back, a web of cracks on the left sides of their plate leaking stormlight into the air.
"It will happen to you too, Blackthorn," Kalanor growled. "If you do kill me, someone will rise up and take your kingdom from you. It will never last."
Dalinar came in for a power swing. One step forward, then a twist all the way about. Kalanor struck him on the right side, a solid hit but insignificant, as it was on the wrong side. Dalinar, on the other hand, came in with a sweeping stroke that hummed in the air. Kalanor tried to move with the blow, but this one had too much momentum. The shard blade connected, destroying the section of plate in an explosion of molten sparks. Kalanor grunted and stumbled to the side, nearly tripping. He lowered his hand to cover the hole in his armor, which continued to leak stormlight at the edges. Half the breastplate had shattered.
"You fight like you lead, Colin," he growled. "Reckless."
Dalinar ignored the taunt and charged instead. Kalanor ran away, plowing through his honor guard in his haste, shoving some aside and sending them tumbling, bones breaking. Dalinar almost caught him, but Kalanor reached the edge of the large rock formation. He dropped his blade, it puffed away to mist, and sprang, grabbing hold of an outcropping. He started to climb. He reached the base of the natural tower moments later. Boulders littered the ground nearby. In the mysterious way of the storms, this had probably been a hillside until recently. The high storm had ripped most of it away, leaving this unlikely formation poking into the air. It would probably soon get blown down. Dalinar dropped his blade and leapt, snagging an outcropping, his fingers grinding on stone. He dangled before getting a footing, then proceeded to climb up the steep wall after Kalanor. The other shardbearer tried to kick rocks down, but they bounced off Dalinar harmlessly. By the time Dalinar caught up, they had climbed some 50 feet. Down below, soldiers gathered and stared, pointing. Dalinar reached for his opponent's leg, but Kalanor yanked it out of the way and then, still hanging from the stones, summoned his blade and began swiping down. After getting battered on the helm a few times, Dalinar growled and let himself slide down out of the way. Kalanor gouged a few chunks from the wall to send them clattering at Dalinar, then dismissed his blade and continued upward. Dalinar followed more carefully, climbing along a parallel route to the side. He eventually reached the top and peeked over the edge. The summit of the formation was some flat-topped, broken peaks that didn't look terribly sturdy. Kalanor sat on one of them, blade across one leg, his other foot dangling. Dalinar climbed up a safe distance from his enemy, then summoned Oathbringer. Storms, there was barely enough room up here to stand. Wind buffeted him, a windspren zipping around to one side.
"Nice view," Kalanor said.
Though the forces had started out with equal numbers, below them were far more fallen men in silver and red strewn across the grassland, than there were men in blue.
I wonder how many kings get such prime seeding to watch their own downfall.
You were never a king, Dalinar said. Kalinar stood and lifted his blade, extending it in one hand, point toward Dalinar's chest.
That, Colden, is all tied up in bearing and assumption. Shall we?
Clever, bringing me up here, Dalinar thought. Dalinar had the obvious edge in a fair duel, and so Kalinar brought random chance into the fight. Winds, unsteady footing, a plunge that would kill even a shard-bearer. At the very least, this would be a novel challenge. Dalinar stepped forward carefully. Kalinar changed to wind stance, a more flowing, sweeping style of fighting. Dalinar chose stone stance for the solid footing and straightforward power. They traded blows, shuffling back and forth along the line of small peaks. Each step scraped chips off the stones, sending them tumbling down. Kalinar obviously wanted to draw out this fight, to maximize the time for Dalinar to slip. Dalinar tested back and forth, letting Kalinar fall into a rhythm, then broke it to strike with everything he had, battering down in overhand blows. Each fanned something burning inside of Dalinar, a thirst that his earlier rampage hadn't sated. The thrill wanted more. Dalinar scored a series of hits on Kalinor's helm, backing him up to the edge, one step away from a fall. The last blow destroyed the helm entirely, exposing an aged face, clean-shaven, mostly bald. Kalinar growled, teeth clenched, and struck back at Dalinar with unexpected ferocity. Dalinar met it blade with blade, then stepped forward to turn it into a shoving match, their weapons locked, neither with room to maneuver. Dalinar met his enemy's gaze. In those light gray eyes he saw something. Excitement. Energy. A familiar bloodlust. Kalinar felt the thrill, too. Dalinar had heard others speak of it, this euphoria of the contest, the secret Alethi edge. But seeing it right there in the eyes of a man trying to kill him made Dalinar furious. He should not have to share such an intimate feeling with this man. He grunted and, in a surge of strength, tossed Kalinar back. The man stumbled, then slipped. He instantly dropped his shard blade and, in a frantic motion, managed to grab the rock lip as he fell. Helmless, Kalinar dangled. The sense of the thrill in his eyes faded to panic.
Mercy, he whispered.
This is a mercy, Dalinar said, then struck him straight through the face with his shard blade. Kalinor's eyes burned from gray to black as he dropped off the spire, trailing twin lines of black smoke. The corpse scraped rock before hitting far below, on the far side of the rock formation, away from the main army. Dalinar breathed out, then sank down, wrung out. Shadows stretched long across the land as the sun met the horizon. It had been a fine fight. He'd accomplished what he'd wanted. He'd conquered all who stood before him. And yet he felt empty. A voice within him kept saying, "That's it? Weren't we promised more?" Down below, a group in Kalinor's colors made for the fallen body. The honor guard had seen where their bright lord had fallen. Dalinar felt a spike of outrage. That was his kill, his victory. He'd won those shards. He scrambled down in a reckless half-climb. The descent was a blur. He was seeing red by the time he hit the ground. One soldier had the blade, others were arguing over the plate, which was broken and mangled. Dalinar attacked, killing six in moments, including the one with the blade. Two others managed to run, but they were slower than he was. Dalinar caught one by the shoulder, whipping him around and smashing him down into the stones. He killed the last with a sweep of Oathbringer. More. Where were more? Dalinar saw no men in red, only some in blue, a beleaguered set of soldiers who flew no flag. In their center, however, walked a man in shard plate. Gavilar rested here from the battle in a place behind the lines to take stock. The hunger inside of Dalinar grew. The thrill came upon him in a rush, overwhelming.
Shouldn't the strongest rule? Why should he sit back so often, listening to men chat instead of war? There was the man who held what he wanted. A throne and more. The woman Dalinar should have been able to claim. A love he'd been forced to abandon. For what reason? No, his fighting today was not done. This was not all. He started toward the group, his mind fuzzy, his insides feeling a deep ache. Passion spren, like tiny crystalline flakes, dropped around him. Shouldn't he have passion? Shouldn't he be rewarded for all he had accomplished? Gavilar was weak. He intended to give up his momentum and rest upon what Dalinar had won for him. Well, there was one way to make certain the war continued. One way to keep the thrill alive. One way for Dalinar to get everything he deserved. He was running. Some of the men in Gavilar's group raised hands in welcome. Weak. No weapons presented against him. He could slaughter them all before they knew what had happened. They deserved it. Dalinar deserved to... Gavilar turned toward him, pulling free his helm and smiling an open, honest grin. Dalinar pulled up, stopping with a lurch. He stared at Gavilar. His brother. Oh, Stormfather, Dalinar thought. What am I doing? He let the blade slip from his fingers and vanish. Gavilar strode up, unable to read Dalinar's horrified expression behind his helm. As a blessing, no shame spren appeared, though he should have earned a legion of them in that moment.
Brother, Gavilar said, have you seen? The day is won. High Prince Ruthar brought down Gallum, winning shards for his son. Talonor took a blade, and I hear you finally drew out Kalinor. Please tell me he didn't escape you.
He... Dalinar licked his lips, breathing in and out.
He is dead.
Dalinar pointed toward the fallen form, visible only as a bit of silvery metal shining amid the shadows of the rubble.
Dalinar! You wonderful, terrible man!
Gavilar turned toward his soldiers.
Hail the Blackthorn men! Hail him!
Glory spren, burst around Gavilar, golden orbs that rotated around his head like a crown. Dalinar blinked amid their cheering and suddenly felt a shame so deep he wanted to crumple up. This time, a single spren, like a falling petal from a blossom, drifted down around him. He had to do something.
Blade and plate,
Dalinar said to Gavilar urgently.
I won them both, but I give them to you. A gift for your children.
Ha! Gavilar said. Yasna! What would she do with shards?
No. You keep them,
Dalinar pled, grabbing his brother by the arm.
Please.
Very well, if you insist, Gavilar said. I suppose you do already have plate to give your heir.
If I have one.
You will, Gavilar said, sending some men to recover Kalinor's blade and plate.
Ha! Tho will have to agree, finally, that we can protect his line. I suspect the wedding will happen within the month.
As would, likely, the official re-coronation, where, for the first time in centuries, all 10 High Princes of Alethkar would bow before a single king. Dalinar sat down on a stone, pulling free his helm and accepting water from a young messenger woman.
Never again, he swore to himself. I give way for Galavar in all things. Let him have the throne. Let him have love. I must never be king.
27. Playing Pretend. I will confess my heresy. I do not back down from the things I have said, regardless of what the Ardents demand. From Oathbringer, Preface. The sounds of arguing politicians drifted to Shallan's ears as she sketched. She sat on a stone seat at the back of the large meeting room near the top of the tower. She'd brought a pillow to sit on, and Pattern buzzed happily on the little pedestal. She sat with her feet up, thighs supporting her drawing pad, stockinged toes curling over the rim of the bench in front of her. Not the most dignified of positions. Radiant would be mortified. At the front of the auditorium, Dalinar stood before the glowing map that Shallan and he, somehow combining their powers, could create. He'd invited Taravangian, the High Princes, their wives, and their head scribes. Elokar had come with Calami, who was scribing for him lately. Renarin stood beside his father in his Bridge IV uniform, looking uncomfortable. So, basically, same as usual. Adolin lounged nearby, arms folded, occasionally whispering a joke toward one of the men of Bridge IV. Radiant should be down there, engaging in this important discussion about the future of the world. Instead, Shallan drew. The light was just so good up here, with these broad glass windows. She was tired of feeling trapped in the dark hallways of the lower levels, always feeling that something was watching her. She finished her sketch, then tipped it toward Pattern, holding the sketchbook with her sleeved safe hand. He rippled up from his post to inspect her drawing. The slot, obstructed by a mashed-up figure with bulging inhuman eyes. Pattern said. Yes, that is correct. It has to be some kind of spren, right? I feel I should know, Pattern said. This is a thing from long ago. Long ago. Shallan shivered. Why is it here? I cannot say, Pattern replied. It is not a thing of us. It is of him. An ancient spren of odium. Delightful. Shallan flipped the page over the top of her sketchbook and started on another drawing. The others spoke further of their coalition. Thelena and Aesir recurring as the most important countries to convince, now that Eri had made it completely clear they had joined the enemy.
Brightness Calami, Dalinar was saying. The last report. It listed a large gathering of the enemy in Marat, was it?
Yes, Bright Lord, the scribe said from her position at the reading desk. Southern Marat. You hypothesized it was the low population of the region that induced the Voidbringers to gather there.
The Iriali have taken the chance to strike eastward, as they've always wanted to, Dalinar said. They'll seize Rira and Babathornum. Meanwhile, areas like Triax around the southern half of central Roshar continue to go dark.
Brightness Calami nodded, and Shallan tapped her lips with her drawing pencil. The question raised an implication. How could cities go completely dark? These days, major cities, particularly ports, would have hundreds of span reeds in operation, every light-eyes or merchant wanting to watch prices or keep in contact with distant estates would have one. Those in Kolinar had started working as soon as the high storms returned, and then they'd been cut off, one by one. Their last reports claimed that armies were gathering near the city. Then, nothing. The enemy seemed to be able to locate span reeds somehow. At least they'd finally gotten word from Kaladin. A single glyph for time, implying they should be patient. He'd been unable to get to a town to find a woman to scribe for him, and just wanted them to know he was safe. Assuming someone else hadn't gotten the span reed, and faked the glyph to put them off.
The enemy is making a play for the Oath Gates, Dalinar decided. All of their motions, save for the gathering in Marat, indicate this. My instincts say that army is planning to strike back at Aesir, or even to cross and try to assault Yakaved. I trust Dalinar's assessment, High Prince Aladar added. If he believes this course to be likely, we should listen.
Bah, said High Prince Ruthar.
The oily man leaned against the wall across from the others, barely paying attention.
Who cares what you say, Aladar? It's amazing you can even see, considering the place you've gone and stuck your head these days.
Aladar spun and thrust his hand to the side in a summoning posture. Dalinar stopped him, as Ruthar must have known that he would.
Shallan shook her head, letting herself instead be drawn farther into her sketching. A few creation spren appeared at the top of her drawing pad, one a tiny shoe, the other a pencil like the one she used. Her sketch was of High Prince Sadeas, drawn without a specific memory. She'd never wanted to add him to her collection. She finished the quick sketch, then flipped to a sketch of Brightlord Peril, the other man they'd found dead in the hallways of Urethiru. She'd tried to recreate his face without wounds. She flipped back and forth between the two.
They do look similar, Shallan decided. Same bulbous features, similar build. Her next two pages were pictures of the two Horn-Eaters. Those two looked roughly similar as well.
And the two murdered women? Why would the man who strangled his wife confess to that murder, but then swear he hadn't killed the second woman? One was already enough to get you executed.
That spren is mimicking the violence, she thought.
Killing or wounding in the same way as attacks from previous days. A kind of impersonation?
Pattern hummed softly, drawing her attention. Shallan looked up to see someone strolling in her direction. A middle-aged woman with short black hair cut almost to the scalp. She wore a long skirt and a buttoning shirt with a vest. Thalen merchant clothing.
"What is that you're sketching, Brightness?" the woman asked in Vaden. Hearing her own language so suddenly was strange to Shallan, and her mind took a moment to sort through the words.
"People," Shallan said, closing her drawing pad. "I enjoy figure drawing. You're the one who came with Taravangian, his surge binder."
"Malata," she said, "though I am not his. I came to him for convenience, as Spark suggested we might look to Urethiru, now that it has been rediscovered."
She surveyed the large auditorium. Shallan could see no sign of her spren.
"Do you suppose we really filled this entire chamber?"
10 orders, Shallan said, "with hundreds of people in most. Yes, I'd assume we could fill it. In fact, I doubt everyone belonging to the orders could fit in here."
"And now there are 4 of us, she said idly, eyeing Renarin, who stood stiff beside his father, sweating beneath the scrutiny as people occasionally glanced at him.
5, Shallan said. "There's a flying bridgeman out there somewhere. And those are only of the ones of us gathered here. There are bound to be others like you who are still looking for a way to reach us."
"If they want to," Malata said. "Things don't have to be the way they were. Why should they? It didn't work out so well last time for the Radiance, did it?"
"Maybe," Shallan said. "But maybe this isn't the time to experiment either. The desolation has started again. We could do worse than rely upon the past to survive this."
"Curious," the woman said, "that we have only the word of a few stuffy Alethi about this entire desolation business. Eh, sister?"
Shallan blinked at the casual way it was said, along with a wink. Malata smiled and sauntered back toward the front of the room.
"Well," Shallan whispered, "she's annoying."
Pattern said. "It will be worse when she starts destroying things."
"Destroying?"
"Dustbringer," Pattern said. "Her spren, they like to break what is around them. They want to know what is inside."
"Pleasant," Shallan said, as she flipped back through her drawings. "The thing in the crack. The dead men. This should be enough to present to Dalinar and Adolin, which she planned to do today, now that she had her sketches done. And after that?
I need to catch it," she thought. "I watched the market. Eventually someone will be hurt. And a few days later, this thing will try to copy that attack. Perhaps she could patrol the unexplored parts of the tower? Look for it, instead of waiting for it to attack?"
the dark corridors, each tunnel like a drawing's impossible line. The room had grown quiet. Shallan shook out of her reverie and looked up to see what was happening. ELA Sadius had arrived at the meeting, carried in a palanquin. She was accompanied by a familiar figure. Meridas Amaram was a tall man, tan-eyed, with a square face and solid figure. He was also a murderer, a thief, and a traitor. He'd been caught trying to steal a shard blade, proof that what Captain Kaladin said about him was true. Shallan gritted her teeth, but found her anger cool. Not gone. No, she would not forgive this man for killing Helleran. But the uncomfortable truth was that she didn't know why or how her brother had fallen to Amaram. She could almost hear Yasna whispering to her, "Don't judge without more details." Below, Adolin had risen and stepped toward Amaram, right into the center of the illusory map, breaking its surface, causing waves of glowing stormlight to ripple across it. He stared murder at Amaram, though Dalinar rested his hand on his son's shoulder, holding him back. "Brightness Sadius," Dalinar said. "I am glad you have agreed to join the meeting. We could use your wisdom in our planning." "I'm not here for your plans, Dalinar," ELA said. "I'm here because it was a convenient place to find you all together. I've been in conference with my advisors back at our estates, and the consensus is that the heir, my nephew, is too young. This is no time for House Sadius to be without leadership, so I've made a decision." "ELA," Dalinar said, stepping into the illusion beside his son. "Let's talk about this. Please, I have an idea that, though untraditional, might—"
"Tradition is our ally, Dalinar," ELA said. "I don't think you've ever understood that as you should. High Marshal Amaram is our house's most decorated and well-regarded general. He is beloved of our soldiers and known the world over. I name him regent and heir to the house title. He is, for all intents, High Prince Sadius now. I would ask the king to ratify this."
Shallan's breath caught. King Elokar looked up from his seat, where he, seemingly, had been lost in thought. "Is this legal?"
"Yes," Navani said, arms folded. "Dalinar," Amaram said, stepping down several of the steps toward the rest of them at the bottom of the auditorium. His voice gave Shallan chills. That refined diction, that perfect face, that crisp uniform. This man was what every soldier aspired to be. "I'm not the only one who is good at playing pretend," she thought.
"I hope," Amaram continued, "our recent friction will not prevent us from working together for the needs of Alethkar. I have spoken to Brightness ELA, and I think I have persuaded her that our differences are secondary to the greater good of Roshar."
"The greater good," Dalinar said. "You think you are one to speak about what is good?"
"Everything I've done is for the greater good, Dalinar," Amaram said, his voice strained. "Everything. Please. I know you intend to pursue legal action against me. I will stand at trial, but let us postpone that until after Roshar has been saved."
Dalinar regarded Amaram for an extended, tense moment. Then he finally looked to his nephew and nodded in a curt gesture.
"The throne acknowledges your act of regency, Brightness," Elokar said to ELA. "My mother will wish a formal writ, sealed and witnessed."
"Already done," ELA said. Dalinar met the eyes of Amaram across the floating map.
"High Prince," Dalinar finally said. "High Prince," Amaram said back, tipping his head.
"Bastard," Adolin said. Dalinar winced visibly, then pointed toward the exit.
"Perhaps, son, you should take a moment to yourself.
Yeah, sure. Adolin pulled out of his father's grip, stalking toward the exit. Shallan thought only a moment, then grabbed her shoes and drawing pad and hurried after him. She caught up to Adolin in the hallway outside, near where the palanquins for the women were parked, and took his arm. Hey, she said softly. He glanced at her and his expression softened. You want to talk? Shallan asked. You seem angrier about him than you were before. No, Adolin muttered. I'm just annoyed. We're finally rid of Sadeus, and now that takes his place? He shook his head. When I was young, I used to look up to him. I started getting suspicious when I was older, but I guess part of me still wanted him to be like they said. A man above all the pettiness and the politics. A true soldier. Shallan wasn't certain what she thought of the idea of a true soldier being the type who didn't care about politics. Shouldn't the why of what a man was doing be important to him? Soldiers didn't talk that way. There was some ideal she couldn't quite grasp, a kind of cult of obedience, of caring only about the battlefield and the challenge it presented. They walked onto the lift, and Adolin fished out a free gemstone, a little diamond not surrounded by a sphere, and placed it into a slot along the railing. Stormlight began to drain from the stone, and the balcony shook, then slowly began to descend. Removing the gem would tell the lift to stop at the next floor. A simple lever pushed one way or the other would determine whether the lift crawled upward or downward. They descended past the top tier, and Adolin took up position by the railing, looking out over the central shaft with the window all along one side. They were starting to call it the atrium, though it was an atrium that ran up dozens upon dozens of floors. Kaladin's not going to like this, Adolin said. Amaram is a high prince. The two of us spent weeks in jail because of the things that man did. I think Amaram killed my brother. Adolin wheeled around to stare at her. What? Amaram has a shard blade, Shallan said. I saw it previously in the hands of my brother, Helleran. He was older than I am and left Yakheved years ago. From what I can gather, he and Amaram fought at some point, and Amaram killed him, taking the blade. Shallan, that blade. You know where Amaram got that, right? On the battlefield? From Kaladin. Adolin raised his hand to his head. The bridge boy insisted that he'd saved Amaram's life by killing a shard bearer. Amaram then killed Kaladin's squad and took the shards for himself. That's basically the entire reason the two hate each other. Shallan's throat grew tight. Oh, tuck it away. Don't think about it. Shallan, Adolin said, stepping toward her, why would your brother try to kill Amaram? Did he maybe know the High Lord was corrupt? Storms. Kaladin didn't know any of that. Poor bridge boy. Everyone would have been better off if he'd just let Amaram die. Don't confront it. Don't think about it. Yeah, she said. Huh. But how did your brother know? Adolin said, pacing across the balcony. Did he say anything? We didn't talk much, Shallan said, numb. He left when I was young. I didn't know him well. Anything to get off this topic. For this was something she could still tuck away in the back of her brain. She did not want to think about Kaladin and Helleran. It was a long, quiet ride to the bottom floors of the tower. Adolin wanted to go visit his father's horse again, but she wasn't interested in standing around smelling horse dung. She got off on the second level to make her way toward her rooms. Secrets. There are more important things in this world, Helleran had said to her father. More important even than you and your crimes. Moraes knew something about this. He was withholding the secrets from her like sweets to entice a child to obedience. But all he wanted her to do was investigate the oddities in Urethiru. That was a good thing, wasn't it? She'd have done it anyway. Shallan meandered through the hallways, following a path where Sabariel's workers had affixed some sphere lanterns to hooks on the walls. Locked up and filled with only the cheapest diamond spheres, they shouldn't be worth the effort to break into, but the light they gave was also rather dim. She should have stayed above. Her absence must have destroyed the illusion of the map. She felt bad about that. Was there a way she could learn to leave her illusions behind her? They'd need Stormlight to keep going. In any case, Shallan had needed to leave the meeting. The secrets this city hid were too engaging to ignore. She stopped in the hallway and dug out her sketchbook, flipping through pages, looking at the faces of the dead men. Absently turning a page, she came across a sketch she didn't recall making. A series of twisting, maddening lines, scribbled and unconnected. She felt cold. "When did I draw this?" Pattern moved up her dress, stopping under her neck. He hummed, an uncomfortable sound. "I do not remember." She flipped to the next page. Here she'd drawn a rush of lines sweeping out from a central point, confused and chaotic, transforming to the heads of horses with the flesh ripping off, their eyes wide, equine mouths screaming. It was grotesque, nauseating. "Oh, Stormfather!" Her fingers trembled as she turned to the next page. She'd scribbled it entirely black, using a circular motion, spiraling toward the center point. A deep void, an endless corridor, something terrible and unknowable at the end. She snapped the sketchbook shut. "What is happening to me?" Pattern hummed in confusion. "Do we run?"
"Where?"
"Away. Out of this place."
"No."
She trembled, part of her terrified, but she couldn't abandon those secrets. She had to have them, hold them, make them hers. She turned sharply in the corridor, taking a path away from her room. A short time later, she strode into the barracks, where Sabariel housed his soldiers. There were plentiful spaces like this in the tower. Vast networks of rooms with built-in stone bunks in the walls. Urethiru had been a military base. That much was evident from its ability to efficiently house tens of thousands of soldiers on the lower levels alone. In the common room of the barracks, men lounged with coats off, playing with cards or knives. Her passing caused a stir as men gaped, then leaped to their feet, debating between buttoning their coats and saluting. Whispers of radiant chased her as she walked into a corridor lined with rooms where the individual platoons bunked. She counted off doorways marked by archaic Alethi numbers etched into the stone, then entered a specific one. She burst in on Vatha and his team, who sat inside playing cards by the light of a few spheres. Poor Gaz sat on the chamber pot in a corner privy, and he yelped, pulling closed the cloth on the doorway. "Guess I should have anticipated that," Shallan thought, covering her blush by sucking in a burst of stormlight. She folded her arms and regarded the others as they, lazily, climbed to their feet and saluted. They were only 12 men now. Some had made their way to other jobs. A few others had died in the Battle of Narok. She'd kind of been hoping that they would all drift away, if only so she wouldn't have to figure out what to do with them. She now realized that Adolin was right. That was a terrible attitude. These men were a resource, and all things considered, had been remarkably loyal. "I," Shallan told them, "have been an awful employer."
"Don't know about that brightness," Red said.
She still didn't know how the tall, bearded man had gotten his nickname.
"The pay has come on time, and you haven't gotten too many of us killed."
"I got killed,"
Shab said from his bunk, where he saluted, still lying down.
Shut up, Shob, Vatha said. You're not dead.
I'm dying this time, Sarge. I'm sure of it.
Then at least you'll be quiet, Vatha said. Brightness, I agree with Red. You've done right by us.
Yes, well, the free ride is over, Shallan said. I have work for you. Vatha shrugged, but some of the others looked disappointed. Maybe Adolin was right. Maybe deep down men like this did need something to do. They wouldn't have admitted that fact, though. I'm afraid it might be dangerous, Shallan said, then smiled. And it will probably involve you getting a little drunk.
28. Another option. Finally, I will confess my humanity. I have been named a monster, and do not deny those claims. I am the monster that I fear we all can become. From Oathbringer, Preface.
The decision has been made, Teshev read, to seal off this Oathgate until we can destroy it. We realize this is not the path you wished for us to take, Dalinar Kholin. Know that the Prime of Aesir considers you fondly and looks forward to the mutual benefit of trade agreements and new treaties between our nations. A magical portal into the very center of our city, however, presents too severe a danger. We will entertain no further pleas to open it and suggest that you accept our sovereign will. Good day, Dalinar Kholin. May Aesir bless and guide you.
Dalinar punched his fist into his palm as he stood in the small stone chamber. Teshev and her ward occupied the riding podium and seat beside it, while Navani had been pacing opposite Dalinar. King Taravangian sat in a chair by the wall, hunched forward with hands clasped, listening with a concerned expression. That was it, then. Aesir was out. Navani touched his arm.
I'm sorry.
There's still Thelenor, Dalinar said. Teshev, see if Queen Fenn will speak with me today.
Yes, Bright Lord.
He had Yakaved and Karbranth from Taravangian, and knew Natanin was responding positively. With Thelenor, Dalinar could at least forge a unified Vorin coalition of all the eastern states. That model might eventually persuade the nations of the west to join with them. If anyone remained by then. Dalinar started pacing again as Teshev contacted Thelenor. He preferred little rooms like this one. The large chambers were a reminder of how enormous this place was. In a small room like this, you could pretend that you were in a cozy bunker somewhere. Of course, even in a small chamber, there were reminders that Urethiru wasn't normal. The strata on the walls, like the folds of a fan, or the holes that commonly showed up at the tops of rooms, right where the walls met the ceiling. The one in this room couldn't help but remind him of Shallan's report. Was something in there, watching them? Could a Spren really be murdering people in the tower? It was nearly enough to make him pull out of the place. But where would they go? Abandon the Oath Gates? For now, he'd quadrupled patrols and sent Navani's researchers searching for a possible explanation. At least until he could come up with a solution. As Teshev wrote to Queen Fenn, Dalinar stepped up to the wall, suddenly bothered by that hole. It was right by the ceiling, and too high for him to reach, even if he stood on a chair. Instead, he breathed in stormlight. The bridgeman had described using stones to climb walls, so Dalinar picked up a wooden chair and painted its back with shining light using the palm of his left hand. When he pressed the back of the chair against the wall, it stuck. Dalinar grunted, tentatively climbing up onto the seat of the chair, which hung in the air at about table height.
Dalinar?
Navani asked.
Might as well make use of the time, he said, carefully balancing on the chair.
He jumped, grabbing the edge of the hole by the ceiling, and pulled himself up to look down it. It was 3 feet wide and about 1 foot tall. It seemed endless, and he could feel a faint breeze coming out of it. Was that scraping he heard? A moment later, a mink slunk into the main tunnel from a shadowed crossroad, carrying a dead rat in its mouth. The tubular little animal twitched its snout toward him, then carried its prize away.
"Air is circulating through those," Navani said as he hopped down off the chair. "The method baffles us. Perhaps some fabrial we have yet to discover?"
Dalinar looked back up at the hole. Miles upon miles of even smaller tunnels threaded through the walls and ceilings of an already daunting system. And hiding in there somewhere, the thing that Shallan had drawn.
"She's replied, right lord," Teshev said.
"Excellent," Dalinar said. "Your Majesty, our time is growing short. I'd like—"
"She's still writing," Teshev said. "Pardon, right lord. She says,
"Just read it, Teshev," Dalinar said. "I'm used to Fen by now."
"Damnation, man. Are you ever going to leave me alone? I haven't slept a full night in weeks. The Everstorm has hit us twice now. We're barely keeping this city from falling apart."
"I understand, your Majesty," Dalinar said, "and am eager to send you the aid I promised. Please, let us make a pact. You've dodged my requests long enough."
Nearby, the chair finally dropped from the wall and clattered to the floor. He prepared himself for another round of verbal sparring, of half-promises and veiled meanings. Fen had been growing increasingly formal during their exchanges. The Spanreed wrote, then halted almost immediately. Teshev looked at him, grave.
"No,"
she read.
"Your Majesty," Dalinar said, "this is not a time to forge on alone. Please, I beg you, listen to me."
"You have to know by now," came the reply, "that this coalition is never going to happen. Colin, I'm baffled, honestly. Your garnet-lit tongue and pleasant words make it seem like you really assume this will work. Surely you see, a queen would have to be either stupid or desperate to let an Alethi army into the very center of her city. I've been the former at times, and I might be approaching the latter. But storms, Colin. No, I'm not going to be the one who finally lets Thelanar fall to you people. And on the off chance that you're sincere, then I'm sorry."
It had an air of finality to it. Dalinar walked over to Teshev, looking at the inscrutable squiggles on the page that somehow made up the women's script.
"Can you think of anything?"
he asked Navani as she sighed and settled down into a chair next to Teshev.
"No. Fen is stubborn, Dalinar."
Dalinar glanced at Terebangian. Even he had assumed Dalinar's purpose was conquest. And who wouldn't, considering his history?
"Maybe it would be different if I could speak to them in person," he thought.
But without the Oath Gates, that was virtually impossible.
"Thank her for her time," Dalinar said, "and tell her my offer remains on the table."
Teshev started writing, and Navani looked to him, noting what the scribe hadn't, the tension in his voice.
"I'm fine," he lied. "I just need time to think."
He strode from the room before she could object, and his guards outside fell into step behind him. He wanted some fresh air. An open sky always seemed so inviting. His feet didn't take him in that direction, however. He instead found himself roaming through the hallways.
What now?
Same as always, people ignored him unless he had a sword in his hand. Storms, it was like they wanted him to come in swinging. He stalked the halls for a good hour, getting nowhere. Eventually, Lynn, the messenger, found him. Panting, she said that Bridge 4 needed him, but hadn't explained why. Dalinar followed her, Shallan's sketch a heavy weight in his mind. Had they found another murder victim? Indeed, Lynn led him to the section where Satius had been killed. His sense of foreboding increased. Lynn led him to a balcony where the bridgemen Layton and Pete met him.
"Who was it?"
he asked as he met them.
"Who?"
Layton frowned.
"Oh, it's not that, sir. It's something else. This way."
Layton led him down some steps onto the wide field outside the first level of the tower, where three more bridgemen waited near some rows of stone planters, probably for growing tubers.
"We noticed this by accident,"
Leighton said as they walked among the planters. The hefty bridgeman had a jovial way about him and talked to Dalinar, a high prince, as easily as he'd talked to friends at a tavern.
"We've been running patrols on your orders, watching for anything strange, and, well, Pete noticed something strange."
He pointed up at the wall.
"See that line?"
Dalinar squinted, picking out a gouge cut into the rock wall. What could score stone like that? It almost looked like... He looked down at the planter boxes nearest them. And there, hidden between two of them, was a hilt protruding from the stone floor. A shard blade. It was easy to miss, as the blade had sunk all the way down into the rock. Dalinar knelt beside it, then took a handkerchief from his pocket and used it to grab the hilt. Even though he didn't touch the blade directly, he heard a very distant whine, like a scream in the back of someone's throat. He steeled himself, then yanked the blade out and set it across the empty planter. The silvery blade curved at the end almost like a fishhook. The weapon was even wider than most shard blades, and near the hilt it rippled in wave-like patterns. He knew this sword, knew it intimately. He'd carried it for decades, since winning it at the Rift all those years ago. Oathbringer. He glanced upward.
The killer must have dropped it out that window. It clipped the stone on its way down, then landed here.
That's what we figured, Bright Lord,
Pete said. Dalinar looked down at the sword. His sword.
No, not mine at all.
He seized the sword, bracing himself for the screams, the cries of a dead spren. They weren't the shrill, painful shrieks he'd heard when touching other blades, but more of a whimper. The sound of a man backed into a corner, thoroughly beaten and facing something terrible, but too tired to keep screaming. Dalinar steeled himself and carried the blade, a familiar weight, with the flat side against his shoulder. He walked toward a different entrance back into the Tower City, followed by his guards, the scout, and the five bridgemen.
"You promise to carry no dead blade?"
the Stormfather thundered in his head.
"Calm yourself," Dalinar whispered. "I'm not going to bond it."
The Stormfather rumbled, low and dangerous.
"This one doesn't scream as loudly as the others. Why?"
"It remembers your oath,"
the Stormfather sent.
"It remembers the day you won it, and better the day you gave it up. It hates you, but less than it hates others."
Dalinar passed a group of Hatham's farmers who had been trying, without success, to get some lavis polyps started. He drew more than a few looks. Even at a tower populated by soldiers, high princes, and radiants, someone carrying a shard blade in the open was an unusual sight.
"Could it be rescued?"
Dalinar whispered as they entered the tower and climbed a stairway.
"Could we save the spren who made this blade?"
"I know of no way," the Stormfather said. "It is dead, as is the man who broke his oath to kill it."
Back to the Lost Radiance and the Recreants. That fateful day when the knights had broken their oaths, abandoned their shards, and walked away. Dalinar had witnessed that in a vision, though he still had no idea what had caused it. Why? What had made them do something so drastic? He eventually arrived at the Sadius section of the tower, and though guards in forest green and white controlled access, they couldn't deny a high prince, particularly not Dalinar. Runners dashed before him to carry word. Dalinar followed them, using their path to judge if he was going in the right direction. He was. She was apparently in her rooms. He stopped at the nice wooden door and gave Iole the courtesy of knocking. One of the runners he had chased here opened the door, still panting. Brightness Sadius sat in a throne set in the center of the room. Amaram stood at her shoulder.
"Dalinar," Iole said, nodding her head to him like a queen greeting a subject.
Dalinar heaved the shard blade off his shoulder and set it carefully on the floor. not as dramatic as spearing it through the stones, but now that he could hear the weapon's screams, he felt like treating it with reverence. He turned to go.
"Bright Lord," Ile said, standing up, "what is this in exchange for?"
"No exchange," Dalinar said, turning back. "That is rightfully yours. My guards found it today. The killer threw it out a window."
She narrowed her eyes at him.
"I didn't kill him, Ile," Dalinar said wearily.
"I realize that. You don't have the bite left in you to do something like that."
He ignored the jibe, looking to Amaram. The tall, distinguished man met his gaze.
"I will see you in judgment someday, Amaram," Dalinar said, "once this is done."
"As I said you could."
"I wish that I could trust your word."
"I stand by what I was forced to do, Bright Lord," Amaram said, stepping forward. "The arrival of the Voidbringers only proves I was in the right. We need practiced shardbearers. The stories of dark eyes gaining blades are charming, but do you really think we have time for nursery tales now instead of practical reality?"
"You murdered defenseless men," Dalinar said through gritted teeth. "Men who had saved your life."
Amaram stooped, lifting Oathbringer.
"And what of the hundreds, even thousands, your wars killed?"
They locked gazes.
"I respect you greatly, Bright Lord," Amaram said. "Your life has been one of grand accomplishment, and you have spent it seeking the good of Alethkar. But you, and take this with the respect I intend, are a hypocrite. You stand where you do because of a brutal determination to do what had to be done. It is because of that trail of corpses that you have the luxury to uphold some lofty, nebulous code. Well, it might make you feel better about your past, but morality is not a thing you can simply doff to put on the helm of battle, then put back on when you're done with the slaughter."
He nodded his head in esteem, as if he hadn't just rammed a sword through Dalinar's gut. Dalinar spun and left Amaram holding Oathbringer. Dalinar's stride down the corridors was so quick that his entourage had to scramble to keep up. He finally found his rooms.
"Leave me,"
he said to his guards and the bridgemen. They hesitated.
"Storm them?"
He turned, ready to lash out, but calmed himself.
"I don't intend to stray in the tower alone. I will obey my own laws. Go."
They reluctantly retreated, leaving his door unguarded. He passed into his outer common room, where he'd ordered most of the furniture to be placed. Navani's heating fabril glowed in a corner near a small rug and several chairs. They finally had enough stormlight to power it. Drawn by the warmth, Dalinar walked up to the fabril. He was surprised to find Taravangian sitting in one of the chairs, staring into the depths of the shining ruby that radiated heat into the room. Well, Dalinar had invited the king to use this common room when he wished. Dalinar wanted nothing but to be alone, and he toyed with leaving. He wasn't sure that Taravangian had noticed him, but that warmth was so welcoming. There were few fires in the tower, and even with the walls to block wind, you always felt chilled. He settled into the other chair and let out a deep sigh. Taravangian didn't address him, bless the man. Together they sat by that not fire, staring into the depths of the gem.
Storms, how he had failed today. There would be no coalition. He couldn't even keep the Alethi High Princes in line.
"Not quite like sitting by a hearth, is it?"
Taravangian finally said, his voice soft.
"No," Dalinar agreed. "I miss the popping of the logs, the dancing of Flamespren."
"It does have its own charm, though. Subtle. You can see the stormlight moving inside."
"Our own little storm," Dalinar said. "Captured, contained, and channeled."
Taravangian smiled, eyes lit by the ruby's stormlight.
"Dalinar Kolin,
Do you mind me asking you something? How do you know what is right?
A lofty question, Your Majesty.
Please, just Taravangian.
Dalinar nodded.
You have denied the Almighty, Taravangian said. No, I am not decrying you as a heretic. I do not care, Dalinar. I've questioned the existence of deity myself.
I feel there must be a god, Dalinar said softly. My mind and soul rebel at the alternative.
Is it not our duty, as kings, to ask questions that make the minds and souls of other men cringe?
Perhaps, Dalinar said.
He studied Taravangian. The king seemed so contemplative.
Yes, there still is some of the old Taravangian in there, Dalinar thought. We have misjudged him. He might be slow, but that doesn't mean he doesn't think. I have felt warmth, Dalinar said, coming from a place beyond. A light I can almost see. If there is a god, it was not the Almighty, the one who called himself Honor. He was a creature, powerful, but still merely a creature.
Then how do you know what is right? What guides you?
Dalinar leaned forward. He thought he could see something larger within the ruby's light, something that moved like a fish in a bowl. Warmth continued to bathe him. Light.
On my 60th day, Dalinar whispered, I passed a town whose name shall remain unspoken. Though still in lands that named me king, I was far enough from my home to go unrecognized. Not even those men who handled my face daily, in the form of my seal imprinted upon their letters of authority, would have known this humble traveler as their king.
Taravangian looked to him, confused.
It's a quote from a book, Dalinar said. A king long ago took a journey. His destination was this very city, Urethiru.
Ah, Taravangian said. The way of kings, is it? Adratagia has mentioned that book.
Yes, Dalinar said. In this town I found men bedeviled. There had been a murder. A hogman, tasked in protecting the landlord's beasts, had been assaulted. He lived long enough only to whisper that three of the other hogmen had gathered together and done the crime. I arrived as questions were being raised and men interrogated. You see, there were four other hogmen in the landlord's employ. Three of them had been responsible for the assault and likely would have escaped suspicion had they finished their grim job. Each of the four loudly proclaimed that he was the one who had not been part of the cabal. No amount of interrogation determined the truth.
Dalinar fell silent.
What happened? Taravangian asked.
He doesn't say at first, Dalinar replied. Throughout his book he raises the question again and again. Three of those men were violent threats, guilty of premeditated murder. One was innocent. What do you do?
Hang all four, Taravangian whispered.
Dalinar, surprised to hear such bloodthirst from the other man, turned.
Taravangian looked sorrowful, not bloodthirsty at all.
The landlord's job, Taravangian said, is to prevent further murders. I doubt that what the book records actually happened. It is too neat, too simple a parable. Our lives are far messier. But assuming the story did occur, as claimed, and there was absolutely no way of determining who was guilty, you have to hang all four, don't you?
What of the innocent man?
One innocent dead, but three murderers stopped. Is it not the best good that can be done, and the best way to protect your people?
Taravangian rubbed his forehead.
Stormfather,
I sound like a madman, don't I? But is it not a particular madness to be charged with such decisions? It's difficult to address such questions without revealing our own hypocrisy.
Hypocrite, Amaram accused Dalinar in his mind. He and Gavilar hadn't used pretty justifications when they'd gone to war. They'd done as men did. They'd conquered. Only later had Gavilar started to seek validation for their actions.
Why not let them all go? Dalinar said. If you can't prove who is guilty, if you can't be sure, I think you should let them go.
Yes? One innocent in four is too many for you. That makes sense, too.
No, any innocent is too many.
You say that, Terebanjian said. Many people do, but our laws will claim innocent men, for all judges are flawed, as is our knowledge. Eventually, you will execute someone who does not deserve it. This is the burden society must carry in exchange for order.
I hate that,
Dalinar said softly. Yes, I do too. But it's not a matter of morality, is it? It's a matter of thresholds. How many guilty may be punished before you'd accept one innocent casualty? 1,000? 10,000? 100? When you consider, all calculations are meaningless except one. Has more good been done than evil? If so, then the law has done its job, and so I must hang all four men. He paused. And I would weep every night for having done it.
Damnation. Again, Dalinar reassessed his impression of Terebanjian. The king was soft-spoken, but not slow. He was simply a man who liked to consider a great long time before committing.
Noadon eventually wrote, Dalinar said, that the landlord took a modest approach. He imprisoned all four. Though the punishment should have been death, he mixed together the guilt and innocence and determined that the average guilt of the four should deserve only prison.
He was unwilling to commit, Terebanjian said. He wasn't seeking justice, but to assuage his own conscience.
What he did was, nevertheless, another option.
Does your king ever say what he would have done? Terebanjian asked. The one who wrote the book?
He said the only course was to let the Almighty guide and let each instance be judged differently, depending on circumstances.
So he, too, was unwilling to commit, Terebanjian said. I would have expected more.
His book was about his journey, Dalinar said, and his questions. I think this was one he never fully answered for himself. I wish he had.
They sat by the knot fire for a time before Terebanjian eventually stood and rested his hand on Dalinar's shoulder.
I understand, he said softly, then left.
He was a good man, the Stormfather said.
Noadon, Dalinar said.
Yes.
Feeling stiff, Dalinar rose from his seat and made his way through his rooms. He didn't stop at the bedroom, though the hour was growing late, and instead made his way onto his balcony to look out over the clouds.
Terebanjian is wrong, the Stormfather said. You are not a hypocrite, son of honor.
I am, Dalinar said softly. But sometimes a hypocrite is nothing more than a person who is in the process of changing. The Stormfather rumbled. He didn't like the idea of change. Do I go to war with the other kingdoms, Dalinar thought, and maybe save the world? Or do I sit here and pretend that I can do all this on my own? Do you have any more visions of Noadon? Dalinar asked the Stormfather, hopeful.
I have shown you all that was created for you to see, the Stormfather said. I can show no more.
Then I should like to rewatch the vision where I met Noadon, Dalinar said. Though let me go fetch Navani before you begin. I want her to record what I say.
Would you rather I show the vision to her as well? The Stormfather asked. She could record it herself that way.
Dalinar froze.
You can show the visions to others? I was given this leave, to choose those who would best be served by the visions.
He paused, then grudgingly continued.
To choose a bondsmith.
No, he did not like the idea of being bonded, but it was part of what he'd been commanded to do. Dalinar barely considered that thought. The Stormfather could show the vision to others.
Anyone, Dalinar said. You can show them to anyone? During a storm I can approach anyone I choose, the Stormfather said. But you do not have to be in a storm, so you can join a vision in which I have placed someone else, even if you are distant.
Storms! Dalinar bellowed a laugh.
What have I done? The Stormfather asked.
You've just solved my problem.
The problem from the Way of Kings?
No, the greater one. I've been wishing for a way to meet with the other monarchs in person. Dalinar grinned. I think that in a coming high storm, Queen Fenn of Thelenna is going to have a quite remarkable experience.
29. No backing down. So sit back, read, or listen to someone who has passed between realms. From Oathbringer, Preface. Vale prowled through the breakaway market, hat pulled low, hands in her pockets. Nobody else seemed to be able to hear the beast that she did. Regular shipments of supplies through Yakived via King Taravangian had set the market bustling. Fortunately, with a third Radiant capable of working the Oathgate now, less of Shallan's time was required. Spheres that glowed again, and several high storms, as proof that that would persist, had encouraged everyone. Excitement was high, trading brisk. Drinks flowed freely from casks emblazoned with the royal seal of Yakived. Lurking within it all, somewhere, was a predator that only Vale could hear. She heard the thing in the silence between laughter. It was the sound of a tunnel extending into the darkness, the feel of breath on the back of your neck in a dark room. How could they laugh while that void watched? It had been a frustrating 4 days. Dalinar had increased patrols to almost ridiculous levels, but those soldiers weren't watching the right way. They were too easily seen, too disruptive. Vale had set her men to a more targeted surveillance in the market. So far they'd found nothing. Her team was tired, as was Shallan, who suffered from the long nights as Vale. Fortunately, Shallan wasn't doing anything particularly useful these days. Sword training with Adolin each day, more frolicking and flirting than useful sword play, and the occasional meeting with Dalinar, where she had nothing to add but a pretty map. Vale, though. Vale hunted the hunter. Dalinar acted like a soldier. Increased patrols. Strict rules. He asked his scribes to find him evidence of Spren attacking people in historical records. He needed more than vague explanations and abstract ideas. But those were the very soul of art. If you could explain something perfectly, then you'd never need art. That was the difference between a table and a beautiful wood cutting. You could explain the table, its purpose, its shape, its nature. The wood cutting you simply had to experience. She ducked into a tent tavern. Did it seem busier in here than on previous nights? Yes. Dalinar's patrols had people on edge.
They were avoiding the darker, more sinister taverns in favor of ones with good crowds and bright lights. Gaz and Red stood beside a pile of crates, nursing drinks and wearing plain trousers and shirts, not uniforms. She hoped they weren't too intoxicated yet. Vale pushed up to their position, crossing her arms on the boxes.
"Nothing yet," Gaz said with a grunt. "Same as the other nights."
"Not that we're complaining," Red added, grinning as he took a long pull on his drink.
"This is the kind of soldiering I can really get behind."
"It's going to happen tonight," Vale said. "I can smell it in the air."
"You said that last night, Vale," Gaz said.
3 nights ago, a friendly game of cards had turned to violence, and one player had hit another over the head with a bottle. That often wouldn't have been lethal, but it had hit just right and killed the poor fellow. The perpetrator, one of Ruthar's soldiers, had been hanged the next day in the market's central square. As unfortunate as the event had been, it was exactly what she'd been waiting for. A seed, an act of violence, one man striking the other. She'd mobilized her team and set them in the taverns near where the fight occurred. "Watch," she'd said. "Someone will get attacked with a bottle in exactly the same way. Pick someone who looks like the man who died, and watch." Shallan had done sketches of the murdered man, a short fellow with long, drooping mustaches. Vale had distributed them. The men took her as no more than another employee. Now, they waited. "The attack will come," Vale said. "Who are your targets?" Red pointed out 2 men in the tent who had mustaches and were of a similar height to the dead man. Vale nodded and dropped a few low-value spheres onto the table. "Get something in you other than booze."
"Sure, sure," Red said, as Gaz grabbed the spheres. "But tell me, sweetness, don't you want to stay here with us a little longer?"
"Most men who have made a pass at me end up missing a finger or two, Red."
"I'd still have plenty left to satisfy you, I promise."
She looked back at him, then started snickering. That was a decently good line.
"Thanks."
He raised his mug.
"So,
sorry, not interested." He sighed, but raised his mug farther before taking a pull on it.
"Where did you come from, anyway?"
Gaz said, inspecting her with his single eye. "Shallan kind of sucked me up along the way, like a boat pulling flotsam into its wake."
"She does that," Red said. "You think you're done, living out the last light of your sphere, you know? And then suddenly you're an honor guard to a storming knight radiant and everyone's looking up to you."
Gaz grunted.
"Ain't that true? Ain't that true?"
"Keep watch," Vale said. "You know what to do if something happens." They nodded.
They'd send one man to the meeting place while the other tried to tail the attacker. They knew there might be something weird about the man they'd chased, but she hadn't told them everything. Vale walked back to the meeting point, near a dais at the center of the market, close to the well. The dais looked like it had once held some kind of official building, but all that remained was the 6-foot-high foundation, with steps leading up to it on 4 sides. Here, Aladar's officers had set up central policing operations and disciplinary facilities. She watched the crowds, while idly spinning her knife in her fingers. Vale liked watching people. That she shared with Shallan. It was good to know how the two of them were different, but it was also good to know what they had in common. Vale wasn't a true loner. She needed people. Yes, she scammed them on occasion, but she wasn't a thief. She was a lover of experience. She was at her best in a crowded market, watching, thinking, enjoying. Now Radiant. Radiant could take people or leave them. They were a tool, but also a nuisance. How could they so often act against their own best interests? The world would be a better place if they'd all simply do what Radiant said. Barring that,
They could at least leave her alone. Vale flipped her knife up and caught it. Radiant and Vale shared efficiency. They liked seeing things done well in the right way. They didn't suffer fools, though Vale could laugh at them while Radiant simply ignored them. Screams sounded in the market. Finally, Vale thought, catching her knife and spinning. She came alert, eager, drawing in Stormlight. Where? Vatha came barreling through the crowd, shoving aside a market-goer. Vale ran to meet him. Details, Vale snapped.
It wasn't like you said, he said. Follow me.
The two took off back the way he'd come. It wasn't a bottle to the head, Vatha said.
My tent is near one of the buildings. The stone ones that were here in the market, you know?
And? She demanded. Vatha pointed as they drew close. You couldn't miss the tall structure beside the tent he and Glurv had been watching. At the top, a corpse dangled from an outcropping, hanged by the neck. Hanged. Storm it. The thing didn't imitate the attack with the bottle. It imitated the execution that followed. Vatha pointed.
Killer dropped the person up there, leaving them to twitch. Then the killer jumped down. All that distance, Vale. How?
Where? She demanded.
Glurv is tailing, Vatha said, pointing.
The two charged in that direction, shoving their way through the crowds. They eventually spotted Glurv up ahead, standing on the edge of the well, waving. He was a squat man with a face that always looked swollen, as if it were trying to burst through its skin.
Man wearing all black, he said, ran straight toward the eastern tunnels.
He pointed toward where troubled market-goers were peering down a tunnel, as if someone had just passed them in a rush. Vale dashed in that direction. Vatha stayed with her longer than Glurv, but with Stormlight she maintained a sprint no ordinary person could match. She burst into the indicated hallway and demanded to know if anyone had seen a man pass this way. A pair of women pointed. Vale followed, heart beating violently, Stormlight raging within her. If she failed the chase, she'd have to wait for two more people to be assaulted, if it even happened again. The creature might hide, now that it knew she was watching. She sprinted down this hallway, leaving behind the more populated sections of the tower. A few last people pointed down a tunnel at her shouted question. She was beginning to lose hope as she reached the end of the hallway at an intersection, and looked one way, then the other. She glowed brightly to light the corridors for a distance, but she saw nothing in either. She let out a sigh, slumping against the wall. Pattern said from her coat. It's there.
Where?
Shallan asked.
To the right. The shadows are off. The wrong pattern.
She stepped forward, and something split out of the shadows, a figure that was jet black. Though like a liquid or a polished stone, it reflected her light. It scrambled away, its shape wrong, not fully human. Vale ran, heedless of the danger. This thing might be able to hurt her, but the mystery was the greater threat. She needed to know these secrets. Shallan skidded around a corner, then barreled down the next tunnel. She managed to follow the broken piece of shadow, but she couldn't quite catch it. The chase led her deeper into the far reaches of the tower's ground floor, to areas barely explored, where the tunnels grew increasingly confusing. The air smelled of old things, of dust and stone left alone for ages. The strata danced on the walls, the speed of her run making them seem to twist around her like threads in a loom. The thing dropped to all fours, light from Shallan's glow reflecting off its coal skin. It ran, frantic, until it hit a turn in the tunnel ahead and squeezed into a hole in the wall 2 feet wide near the floor. Radiant dropped to her knees, spotting the thing as it wriggled out the other side of the hole. Not that thick, she thought, standing. Pattern, she demanded, thrusting her hand to the side. She attacked the wall with her shard blade, slicing chunks free, dropping them to the floor with a clatter. The strata ran all the way through the stone, and the pieces she carved off had a forlorn, broken beauty to them.
Engorged with light, she shoved up against the sliced wall, finally breaking through into a small room beyond. Much of its floor was taken up by the mouth of a pit. Circled by stone steps with no railing, the hole bored down through the rock into darkness. Radiant lowered her shard blade, letting it slice into the rock at her feet. A hole, like her drawing of spiraling blackness, a pit that seemed to descend into the void itself. She released her shard blade, falling to her knees. "Shallan?" Pattern asked, rising up from the ground near where the blade had vanished. "We'll need to descend."
"Now?"
She nodded. "But first, go and get Adolin. Tell him to bring soldiers." Pattern hummed.
"You won't go alone, will you?"
"No, I promise. Can you make your way back?" Pattern buzzed affirmatively, then zipped off across the ground, dimpling the floor of the rock. Curiously, the wall near where she'd broken in showed the rust marks and remnants of ancient hinges, so there was a secret door to get into this place. Shallan kept her word. She was drawn toward that blackness, but she wasn't stupid. Well, mostly not stupid. She waited, transfixed by the pit, until she heard voices from the hallway behind her. "He can't see me in Vale's clothing," she thought, and started to reawaken. How long had she been kneeling there? She took off Vale's hat and long white coat, then hid them behind the debris. Stormlight enfolded her, painting the image of a Hava over her trousers, gloved hand, and tight-buttoned shirt. Shallan. She was Shallan again. Innocent, lively Shallan. Quick with a quip, even when nobody wanted to hear it. Earnest, but sometimes over-eager. She could be that person. "That's you," a part of her cried as she adopted the persona. "That's the real you, isn't it? Why do you have to paint that face over another?" She turned as a short, wiry man in a blue uniform entered the room, gray dusting his temples. What was his name again? She'd spent some time around Bridge 4 in the last few weeks, but still hadn't learned them all. Adolin strode in next, wearing Kulin blue shard plate, faceplate up, blade resting on his shoulder. Judging from the sounds out in the hallway and the Herdazian faces that peeked into the room, he had brought not only soldiers, but the entirety of Bridge 4. That included Renarin, who clomped in after his brother, clad in slate-colored shardplate. Renarin looked far less frail when fully armored, though his face didn't seem like a soldier's, even if he had stopped wearing his spectacles. Pattern approached and tried to slide up her illusory dress, but then stopped, backing away and humming in pleasure at the lie.
"I found him," he proclaimed. "I found Adolin."
"I see that," Shallan said.
"He came at me," Adolin said, "in the training rooms, screaming that you'd found the killer. Said that if I didn't come, you'd probably," and I quote, "go do something stupid without letting me watch."
Pattern hummed.
"Stupidity. Very interesting."
"You should visit the Alethi court sometime," Adolin said, stepping over to the pit.
"So, we tracked the thing that has been assaulting people," Shallan said. "It killed someone in the market. Then it came here."
"The thing?"
one of the bridgemen said.
"Not a person?"
"It's a spren," Shallan whispered. "But not like one I've ever seen. It's able to imitate a person for a time, but it eventually becomes something else. A broken face, a twisted shape."
"Sounds like that girl you've been seeing, Scar," one of the bridgemen noted.
"Ha ha," Scar said dryly. "How about we toss you in that pit, Eth? And see how far down this thing goes." "Saw this spren," Lopin said, approaching the pit. "It, sure,
killed High Prince Sadeus?
Shallan hesitated. No. It had killed Peril in copying the Sadeus murder, but someone else had murdered the High Prince. She glanced at Adolin, who must have been thinking the same thing, for how solemn his expression was. The Spren was the greater threat. It had performed multiple murders. Still, it made her uncomfortable to acknowledge that her investigation hadn't taken them a single step closer to finding who had killed the High Prince.
"We must have passed by this point a dozen times," a soldier said from behind.
Shallan started. That voice was female. Indeed, she'd mistaken one of Dalinar's scouts, the short woman with long hair, for another bridgeman, though her uniform was different. She was inspecting the cuts Shallan had made to get into this room.
"Don't you remember scouting right past that curved hallway outside, Teft?"
Teft nodded, rubbing his bearded chin.
"Yeah, you're right, Lin. But why hide a room like this?"
"There's something down there," Renarin whispered, leaning out over the pit. "Something ancient. You felt it, haven't you?"
He looked up at Shallan, then the others in the room.
"This place is weird. This whole tower is weird. You've noticed it too, right?"
"Kid," Teft said, "you're the expert on what's weird. We'll trust your word."
Shallan looked with concern toward Renarin at the insult. He just grinned, as one of the other bridgemen slapped him on the back, plate notwithstanding, while Lopan and Rock started arguing over who was truly the weirdest among them. In a moment of surprise, she realized that Bridge 4 had actually assimilated Renarin. He might be the light-eyed son of a high prince, resplendent in shard plate, but here he was just another bridgeman.
"So,"
one of the men said, a handsome, muscled fellow with arms that seemed too long for his body.
"I assume we're heading down into this awful crypt of terror?"
"Yes," Shallan said. She thought his name was Dre.
"Storming lovely," Dre said. "Marching orders, Teft?" "That's up to Bright Lord Adolin."
"I brought the best men I could find," Adolin said to Shallan. "But I feel like I should bring an entire army instead. You sure you want to do this now?"
"Yes," Shallan said. "We have to, Adolin. And I don't know that an army would make a difference."
"Very well. Teft, give us a hefty rear guard. I don't fancy having something sneak up on us. Lin, I want accurate maps. Stop us if we get too far ahead of your drawing. I want to know my exact line of retreat. We go slowly, men. Be ready to perform a controlled, careful retreat if I command it."
Some shuffling of personnel followed. Then the group finally started down the staircase, single file, Shallan and Adolin near the center of the pack. The steps jutted right from the wall, but were wide enough that people would be able to pass on their way up, so there was no danger of falling off. She tried to keep from brushing anyone, as it might disturb the illusion that she was wearing her dress. The sound of their footsteps vanished into the void. Soon they were alone with the timeless, patient darkness. The light of the sphere lanterns the bridgemen carried didn't seem to stretch far in that pit. It reminded Shallan of the mausoleum carved into the hill near her manor, where ancient Davar family members had been soul-cast to statues. Her father's body hadn't been placed there. They had lacked the funds to pay for a soul caster, and besides, they'd wanted to pretend he was alive. She and her brothers had burned the body, as the Dark Eyes did.
Pain.
"I have to remind you, Brightness," Teft said from in front of her. "You can't expect anything extraordinary from my men. For a bit, some of us sucked up light and strutted about like we were storm-blessed. That stopped when Kaladin left."
"He'll come back, Gancho," Lopan said from behind her. "When Kaladin returns, we'll glow again good."
"Hush, Lopan," Teft said. "Keep your voice down. Anyway, Brightness, the lads will do their best, but you need to know what and what not to expect."
Shallan hadn't been expecting radiant powers from them. She'd known about their limitation already. All she needed were soldiers. Eventually, Lopan tossed a diamond chip into the hole, earning him a glare from Adolin.
"It might be down there waiting for us," the prince hissed. "Don't give it warning."
The bridgeman wilted, but nodded. The sphere bounced as a visible pinprick below, and Shallan was glad to know that at least there was an end to this descent. She'd begun to imagine an infinite spiral, like with old Dilid, one of the 10 fools. He ran up a hillside toward the tranquiline halls with sand sliding beneath his feet, running for eternity, but never making progress. Several bridgemen let out audible sighs of relief as they finally reached the bottom of the shaft. Here, piles of splinters scattered at the edges of the round chamber, covered in decay spren. There had once been a banister for the steps, but it had fallen to the effects of time. The bottom of the shaft had only one exit, a large archway more elaborate than others in the tower. Up above, almost everything was the same uniform stone, as if this whole tower had been carved in one go. Here the archway was of separately placed stones, and the walls of the tunnel beyond were lined with bright mosaic tiles. Once they entered the hall, Shallan gasped, holding up a diamond brome. Gorgeous, intricate pictures of the heralds, made of thousands of tiles, adorned the ceiling, each in a circular panel. The art on the walls was more enigmatic. A solitary figure, hovering above the ground before a large blue disc, arms stretched to the side as if to embrace it. Depictions of the Almighty in his traditional form as a cloud bursting with energy and light. A woman in the shape of a tree, hands spreading toward the sky and becoming branches. Who would have thought to find pagan symbols in the home of the Knights Radiant? Other murals depicted shapes that reminded her of Pattern. Wind spren. 10 kinds of spren. One for each order? Adolin sent a vanguard a short distance ahead, and soon they returned. "Metal doors ahead, Bright Lord," Lin said. "One on each side of the hall." Shallan pried her eyes away from the murals, joining the main body of the force as they moved. They reached the large steel doors and stopped, though the corridor itself continued onward. At Shallan's prompting, the bridgemen tried them but couldn't get them open.
"Locked," Dre said, wiping his brow.
Adolin stepped forward, sword in hand.
"I've got a key."
"Adolin," Shallan said, "these are artifacts from another time, valuable and precious."
"I won't break them too much," he promised.
"But aren't we chasing a murderer?" he said. "Someone who is likely to, say, hide in a locked room." She sighed, then nodded as he waved everyone back. She tucked her safe hand, which had brushed him, back under her arm. It was so strange to feel like she was wearing a glove, but to see her hand as sleeved. Would it really have been so bad to let Adolin know about Vale? A part of her panicked at the idea, so she let go of it quickly. Adolin rammed his blade through the door just above where the lock or bar would be, then swept it down. Teft tried the door and was able to shove it open, hinges grinding loudly. The bridgeman ducked in first, spears in hand. For all Teft's insistence that she wasn't to expect anything exceptional of them, they took point without orders, even though there were 2 shard-bearers at the ready. Adolin rushed in after the bridgeman to secure the room, though Renarin wasn't paying much attention. He'd walked a few steps farther down the main corridor, and now stood still, staring deeper into the depths, sphere held absently in one gauntleted hand, shard blade in the other. Shallan stepped up hesitantly beside him. A cool breeze blew from behind them, as if being sucked into that darkness. The mystery lurked in that direction, the captivating depths. She could sense it more distinctly now. Not an evil, really, but a wrongness, like the sight of a wrist hanging from an arm after the bone is broken.
"What is it?" Renarin whispered.
Gliss is frightened and won't speak.
Pattern doesn't know, Shallan said. He calls it ancient, says it's of the enemy.
Renarin nodded.
Your father doesn't seem to be able to feel it, Shallan said. Why can we?
I don't know.
Maybe...
Shallan, Adolin said, looking out of the room, his faceplate up.
You should see this.
The wreckage inside the room was more decayed than most they'd found in the tower. Rusted clasps and screws clung to bits of wood. Decomposed heaps ran in rows, containing bits of fragile covers and spines.
A library. They'd finally found the books Yasna had dreamed of discovering. They were ruined. With a sinking feeling, Shallan moved through the room, nudging at piles of dust and splinters with her toes, frightening off decay spren. She found some shapes of books, but they disintegrated at her touch. She knelt between two rows of fallen books, feeling lost. All that knowledge. Dead and gone.
Sorry, Adolin said, standing awkwardly nearby.
Don't let the men disturb this. Maybe there's something Navani's scholars can do to recover it.
Want us to search the other room? Adolin asked.
She nodded, and he clanked off. A short time later, she heard hinges creak as Adolin forced open the door. Shallan suddenly felt exhausted. If these books here were gone, then it was unlikely they'd find others better preserved.
Forward.
She rose, brushing off her knees, which only reminded her that her dress wasn't real.
You aren't here for this secret anyway.
She stepped out into the main hallway, the one with the murals. Adolin and the bridgeman were exploring the room on the other side, but a quick glance showed Shallan that it was a mirror of the one they'd left, furnished only with piles of debris.
Guys?
Lynn, the scout, called.
Prince Adolin? Brightness radiant?
Shallan turned from the room. Renarin had walked farther down the corridor. The scout had followed him, but had frozen in the hallway. Renarin's sphere illuminated something in the distance. A large mass that reflected the light, like glistening tar.
We shouldn't have come here, Renarin said. We can't fight this. Stormfather.
He stumbled backward.
Stormfather!
The bridgeman hastened into the hallway in front of Shallan, between her and Renarin. At a barked order from Teft, they made a formation spanning from one side of the main hallway to the other, a line of men holding spears low, with a second line behind holding more spears higher in an overhand grip. Adolin burst out of the second library room, then gaped at the undulating shape in the distance, a living darkness. That darkness seeped down the hallway. It wasn't fast, but there was an inevitability about the way it coated everything, flowing up the sides of the walls onto the ceiling. On the ground, shapes split from the main mass, becoming figures that stepped as if from the surf. Creatures that had 2 feet and soon grew faces, with clothing that rippled into existence.
"She's here," Renarin whispered. "One of the Unmade. Rey Shafir. The Midnight Mother."
"Run, Shallan!" Adolin shouted. "Men, start back up the hall!"
Then, of course, he charged at the flood of things. The figures, they look like us, Shallan thought, stepping back, farther from the line of bridgemen. There was one midnight creature that looked like Teft, and another that was a copy of Lopen. 2 larger shapes seemed to be wearing shard plate, except they were made of shiny tar, their features blobby, imperfect. The mouths opened, sprouting spiny teeth.
"Make a careful retreat, like the prince ordered," Teft called. "Don't get boxed in, men. Hold the line. Renarin!"
Renarin still stood out in front, holding forth his shard blade, long and thin with a waving pattern to the metal. Adolin reached his brother, then grabbed his arm and tried to tow him back.
He resisted. He seemed mesmerized by that line of forming monsters.
"Renarin, attention!"
Teft shouted.
"To the line!"
The boy's head snapped up at the command, and he scrambled, as if he weren't the cousin of the king, to obey his sergeant's order. Adolin retreated with him, and the two fell into formation with the bridgemen. Together they pulled backward through the main hall. Shallan backed up, staying roughly 20 feet behind the formation. Suddenly the enemy moved with a burst of speed. Shallan cried out, and the bridgemen cursed, turning spears as the main mass of darkness swept up along the sides of the corridor, covering the beautiful murals. The midnight figures dashed forward, charging the line. An explosive, frantic clash followed, bridgemen holding formation and striking at creatures who suddenly began forming on the right and left, coming out of the blackness on the walls. The things bled vapor when struck, a darkness that hissed from them and dissipated into the air. Like smoke, Shallan thought. The tar swept down from the walls, surrounding the bridgemen, who circled to keep themselves from being attacked at the rear. Adolin and Renarin fought at the very front, hacking with blades, leaving dark figures to hiss and gush smoke in pieces. Shallan found herself separated from the soldiers, an inky blackness between them. There didn't seem to be a duplicate for her. The midnight faces bristled with teeth. Though they thrust with spears, they did so awkwardly. They struck true now and then, wounding a bridgeman, who would pull back into the center of the formation to be hastily bandaged by Lin or Lopin. Renarin fell into the center and started to glow with stormlight, healing those who were hurt. Shallan watched all this, feeling a numbing trance settle over her.
"I know you," she whispered to the blackness, realizing it was true. "I know what you're doing."
Men grunted and stabbed. Adolin swept before himself, shardblade trailing black smoke from the creature's wounds. He chopped apart dozens of the things, but new ones continued forming, wearing familiar shapes. Dalinar, Teshev, high princes and scouts, soldiers and scribes.
"You try to imitate us," Shallan said, "but you fail. You're a Spren. You don't quite understand."
She stepped toward the surrounded bridgeman. "Shallan," Adolin called, grunting as he cleaved three figures before him.
"Escape! Run!"
She ignored him, stepping up to the darkness. In front of her, at the closest point of the ring, Dre stabbed a figure straight through the head, sending it stumbling back. Shallan seized its shoulders, spinning it toward her. It was Navani, a gaping hole in her face, black smoke escaping with a hiss. Even ignoring that, the features were off, the nose too big, one eye a little higher than the other. It dropped to the floor, writhing as it deflated like a punctured wineskin. Shallan strode right up to the formation. The things fled her, shying to the sides. Shallan had the distinct and terrifying impression that these things could have swept the bridgemen away at will, overwhelming them in a terrible black tide. But the Midnight Mother wanted to learn. She wanted to fight with spears. If that was so, however, she was growing impatient. The newer figures forming up were increasingly distorted, more bestial, spiny teeth spilling from their mouths.
"Your imitation is pathetic," Shallan whispered. "Here, let me show you how it's done."
Shallan drew in her stormlight, going alight like a beacon. Things screamed, pulling away from her. As she stepped around the formation of worried bridgemen, wading into the blackness at their left flank, figures extended from her, shapes growing from light. The people from her recently rebuilt collection. Palona, soldiers from the hallways, a group of soulcasters she'd passed 2 days ago, men and women from the markets, high princes and scribes, the man who had tried to pick up Vale at the tavern, the horn eater she'd stabbed in the hand, soldiers, cobblers, scouts, washwomen,
even a few kings. A glowing, radiant force. Her figures spread out to surround the beleaguered bridgemen like sentries. This new glowing force drove the enemy monsters back, and the tar withdrew along the sides of the hall until the path of retreat was open. The Midnight Mother dominated the darkness at the end of the hall, the direction they had not yet explored. It waited there, and did not recede farther. The bridgeman relaxed, Renarin muttering as he healed the last few who had been hurt. Shallan's cohort of glowing figures moved forward and formed a line with her, between darkness and bridgeman. The creatures formed again from the blackness ahead, growing more ferocious, like beasts. Featureless blobs with teeth sprouting from slit mouths.
"How are you doing this?" Adolin asked, voice ringing from within his helm. "Why are they afraid?"
"Has someone with a knife, not knowing who you were, ever tried to threaten you?"
"Yeah. I just summoned my shard blade."
"It's a little like that."
Shallan stepped forward and Adolin joined her. Renarin summoned his blade and took a few quick steps to reach them, his plate clicking. The darkness pulled back, revealing that the hallway opened up into a room ahead. As she approached, Shallan's stormlight illuminated a bowl-like chamber. The center was dominated by a heaving black mass that undulated and pulsed, stretching from floor to ceiling some 20 feet above. The midnight beasts tested forward against her light, no longer seeming as intimidated.
"We have to choose," Shallan said to Adolin and Renarin. "Retreat or attack?"
"What do you think?"
"I don't know. This creature, she's been watching me. She's changed how I see the tower. I feel like I understand her. A connection I cannot explain. That can't be a good thing, right? Can we even trust what I think?"
Adolin raised his faceplate and smiled at her.
"Storms. That smile.
High Marshal Halad always said that to beat someone you must first know them. It's become one of the rules we follow in warfare."
"And what did he say about retreat?"
"Plan every battle as if you will inevitably retreat, but fight every battle like there is no backing down."
The main mass in the chamber undulated, faces appearing from its tarry surface, pressing out as if trying to escape. There was something beneath the enormous spren. Yes, it was wrapped around a pillar that reached from the floor of the circular room to its ceiling. The murals, the intricate art, the fallen troves of information. This place was important. Shallan clasped her hands before herself, and the pattern blade formed in her palms. She twisted it in a sweaty grip, falling into the dueling stance Adolin had been teaching her. Holding it immediately brought pain. Not the screaming of a dead spren. Pain inside. The pain of an ideal sworn but not yet overcome.
"Bridgeman!" Adolin called. "You willing to give it another go?"
"We'll last longer than you will, Gancho. Even with your fancy armor."
Adolin grinned and slammed his faceplate down.
"At your word, Radiant."
She sent her illusions in, but the darkness didn't shy before them as it had previously. Black figures attacked her illusions, testing to find that they weren't real. Dozens of these midnight men clogged their way forward.
"Clear the way for me to the thing in the center," she said, trying to sound more certain than she felt. "I need to get close enough to touch her."
"Renarin can guard my back?" Adolin asked.
Renarin nodded. Adolin took a deep breath, then charged into the room, bursting right through the middle of an illusion of his father. He struck at the first midnight man, chopping it down, then began sweeping around him in a frenzy. Bridge Four shouted, rushing in behind him. Together they began to form a path for Shallan, slaying the creatures between her and the pillar. She walked through the bridgemen, a rank of them forming a spear line to either side of her. Ahead, Adolin pushed toward the pillar, Renarin at his back, preventing him from being surrounded, bridgemen in turn pushing up along the sides to keep Renarin from being overwhelmed.
The monsters no longer bore even a semblance of humanity. They struck Adolin, two real claws and teeth scraping his armor. Others clung to him, trying to weigh him down or find chinks in the shard plate.
They know how to face men like him, Shallan thought, still holding her shard blade in one hand. Why then do they fear me?
Shallan wove light, and a version of Radiant appeared near Renarin. The creatures attacked it, leaving Renarin for a moment. Unfortunately, most of her illusions had fallen, collapsing into stormlight as they were disrupted again and again. She could have kept them going, she thought, with more practice. Instead, she wove versions of herself, young and old, confident and frightened, a dozen different Shallans. With a shock, she realized that several were pictures she'd lost, self-portraits she'd practiced with a mirror, as Dandos the Oilsworn had insisted was vital for an aspiring artist. Some of herself cowered, others fought. For a moment, Shallan lost herself, and she even let Vale appear among them. She was those women, those girls, every one of them, and none of them were her. They were things she used, manipulated, illusions.
Shallan!
Adolin shouted, voice straining as Renarin grunted and ripped midnight men off him.
Whatever you're going to do, do it now!
She'd stepped up to the front of the column the soldiers had won for her, right near Adolin. She tore her gaze away from a child Shallan dancing among the midnight men. Before her, the main mass, coating the pillar in the center of the room, bubbled with faces that stretched against the surface, mouths opening to scream, then submerged like men drowning in tar.
Shallan!
Adolin said again. That pulsing mass, so terrible, but so captivating. The image of the pit, the twisting lines of the corridors, the tower that couldn't be completely seen. This was why she'd come. Shallan strode forward, arm out, and let the illusory sleeve covering her hand vanish. She pulled off her glove, stepped right up to the mass of tar and voiceless screams, then pressed her safe hand against it.
30. Mother of Lies. Listen to the words of a fool. From Oathbringer, Preface. Shallan was open to this thing, laid bare, her skin split, her soul gaping wide. It could get in. It was also open to her. She felt its confused fascination with humankind. It remembered men, an innate understanding, much as newborn mink kits innately knew to fear the sky eel. This Spren was not completely aware, not completely cognizant. She was a creation of instinct and alien curiosity, drawn to violence and pain like scavengers to the scent of blood. Shallan knew Ray Shafir at the same time as the thing came to know her. The Spren tugged and prodded at Shallan's bond with Pattern, seeking to rip it free and insert herself instead. Pattern clung to Shallan and she to him, holding on for dear life.
She fears us, Pattern's voice buzzed in her head. Why does she fear us?
In her mind's eye, Shallan envisioned herself holding tightly to Pattern in his humanoid form, the two of them huddled down before the Spren's attack. That image was all she could see at the moment, for the room and everything in it had dissolved to black.
This thing was ancient.
Created long ago as a splinter of the soul of something even more terrible, Ray Shafir had been ordered to sow chaos, spawning horrors to confuse and destroy men. Over time, slowly, she'd become increasingly intrigued by the things she murdered. Her creations had come to imitate what she saw in the world, but lacking love or affection, like stones come alive, content to be killed or to kill with no attachment or enjoyment. No emotions beyond an overpowering curiosity and that ephemeral attraction to violence.
Almighty above, it's like a creation, Spren.
Only so, so wrong.
Pattern whimpered, huddled against Shallan in his shape of a man with a stiff robe and a moving pattern for a head. She tried to shield him from the onslaught.
Fight every battle, as if there is no backing down.
Shallan looked into the depths of the swirling void, the dark spinning soul of Ray Shafir, the Midnight Mother. Then, growling, Shallan struck. She didn't attack like the prim, excitable girl who had been trained by cautious Voran society. She attacked like the frenzied child who had murdered her mother, the cornered woman who had stabbed Tin through the chest. She drew upon the part of her that hated the way everyone assumed she was so nice, so sweet, the part of her that hated being described as diverting or clever. She drew upon the stormlight within and pushed herself farther into Ray Shafir's essence. She couldn't tell if it was actually happening, if she was pushing her physical body farther into the creature's tar, or if this was all a representation of someplace else, a place beyond this room in the tower, beyond even Shadesmar. The creature trembled, and Shallan finally saw the reason for its fear. It had been trapped. The event had happened recently in the Spren's Reckoning, though Shallan had the impression that in fact centuries upon centuries had passed. Ray Shafir was terrified of it happening again. The imprisonment had been unexpected, presumed impossible, and it had been done by a lightweaver like Shallan, who had understood this creature. It feared her like an axe hound might fear someone with a voice similar to that of its harsh master. Shallan hung on, pressing herself against the enemy, but realization washed over her, the understanding that this thing was going to know her completely, discover each and every one of her secrets. Her ferocity and determination wavered. Her commitment began to seep away. So she lied. She insisted that she wasn't afraid. She was committed. She'd always been that way. She would continue that way forever. Power could be an illusion of perception, even within yourself.
Ray Shafir broke.
It screeched, a sound that vibrated through Shallan. A screech that remembered its imprisonment and feared something worse. Shallan dropped backward in the room where they'd been fighting. Adolin caught her in a steel grip, going down on one knee with an audible crack of plate against stone. She heard that echoing scream fading. Not dying. Fleeing. Escaping. Determined to get as far from Shallan as it could. When she forced her eyes open, she found the room clean of the darkness. The corpses of the midnight creatures had dissolved. Renarin quickly knelt next to a bridgeman who had been hurt, removing his gauntlet and infusing the man with healing stormlight. Adolin helped Shallan sit up, and she tucked her exposed safe hand under her other arm. Storms! She'd somehow kept up the illusion of the Hava. Even after all of that, she didn't want Adolin to know of Vale. She couldn't.
Where?
She asked him, exhausted.
Where did it go?
Adolin pointed toward the other side of the room where a tunnel extended farther down into the depths of the mountain.
It fled in that direction like moving smoke. So, should we chase it down?
Eth asked, making his way carefully toward the tunnel. His lantern revealed steps cut into the stone.
This goes down a long ways.
Shallan could feel a change in the air. The tower was different. Don't give chase, she said, remembering the terror of that conflict. She was more than happy to let the thing run. We can post guards in this chamber, but I don't think she'll return.
Yeah,
Teft said, leaning on his spear and wiping sweat from his face.
Guards seem like a very, very good idea.
Shallan frowned at the tone of his voice, then followed his gaze to look at the thing Ray Shafir had been hiding. The pillar, in the exact center of the room.
It was set with thousands upon thousands of cut gemstones, most larger than Shallan's fist. Together, they were a treasure worth more than most kingdoms.
31. Demands of the Storm. If they cannot make you less foolish, at least let them give you hope. From Oathbringer, Preface. Throughout his youth, Kaladin had dreamed of joining the military and leaving quiet little Hearthstone. Everyone knew that soldiers traveled extensively and saw the world. And he had. He'd seen dozens upon dozens of empty hills, weed-covered plains, and identical war camps. Actual sights, though? Well, that was another story. The city of Revelar was, as his hike with the Parshmen had proven, only a few weeks away from Hearthstone by foot. He'd never visited. Storms, he'd never actually lived in a city before, unless you counted the war camps. He suspected most cities weren't surrounded by an army of Parshmen as this one was. Revelar was built in a nice hollow on the leeward side of a series of hills, the perfect spot for a little town. Except this was not a little town. The city had sprawled out, filling in the areas between the hills, going up the leeward slopes, only leaving the tips completely bare. He'd expected a city to look more organized. He'd imagined neat rows of houses, like an efficient war camp. This looked more like a snarl of plants clumped in a chasm at the shattered plains. Streets running this way and that, markets that poked out haphazardly. Kaladin joined his team of Parshmen as they wound along a wide roadway kept level with smoothed creme. They passed through thousands upon thousands of Parshmen camped here, and more gathered by the hour, it seemed. His, however, was the only group that carried stone-headed spears on their shoulders, packs of dried grain biscuits, and hogshide leather sandals. They tied their smocks with belts and carried stone knives, hatchets, and tinder in waxed sleeves made from candles he'd traded for. He'd even begun teaching them to use a sling. He probably shouldn't have shown them any of these things. That didn't stop him from feeling proud as he walked with them, entering the city. Crowds thronged the streets. Where had all these Parshmen come from? This was a force of at least 40 or 50,000. He knew most people ignored Parshmen, and, well, he'd done the same. But he'd always had tucked in the back of his mind this idea that there weren't that many out there. Each high-ranking Light Eyes owned a handful, and a lot of the caravaneers, and, well, even the less wealthy families from cities or towns had them. And there were the dock workers, the miners, the water haulers, the packmen they used when building large projects.
"It's amazing," Soss
said from where he walked beside Kaladin, carrying his daughter on his shoulders to give her a better view. She clutched some of his wooden cards, holding them close like another child might carry a favorite stuffed doll.
"Amazing?"
Kaladin asked Saw.
"Our own city, Cal," he whispered. "During my time as a slave, barely able to think, I still dreamed. I tried to imagine what it would be like to have my own home, my own life. Here it is."
The Parshmen had obviously moved into homes along the streets here. Were they running markets, too? It raised a difficult, unsettling question. Where were all the humans? Ken's group walked deeper into the city, still led by the unseen Spren. Kaladin spotted signs of trouble. Broken windows, doors that no longer latched. Some of that would be from the Everstorm, but he passed a couple of doors that had obviously been hacked open with axes. Looting. And ahead stood an inner wall. It was a nice fortification, right in the middle of the city sprawl. It probably marked the original city boundary, as decided upon by some optimistic architect. Here, at long last, Kaladin found signs of the fight he'd expected during his initial trip to Alethkar. The gates to the inner city lay broken. The guardhouse had been burned, and arrowheads still stuck from some of the wood beams they passed. This was a conquered city. But where had the humans been moved? Should he be looking for a prison camp? Or a heaping pyre of burned bones? Considering the idea made him sick. "Is this what it's about?" Kaladin said as they walked down a roadway in the inner city. "Is this what you want, sir? To conquer the kingdom? Destroy humankind?" "Storms, I don't know," he said. "But I can't be a slave again, Cal. I won't let them take by and imprison her. Would you defend them, after what they did to you?" "They're my people." "That's no excuse. If one of your people murders another, don't you put them in prison? What is a just punishment for enslaving my entire race?"
Syl soared past, her face peeking from a shimmering haze of mist. She caught his eye, then zipped over to a windowsill and settled down, taking the shape of a small rock.
Kaladin said. "I don't know, sir. But a war to exterminate one side or the other can't be the answer." "You can fight alongside us, Cal. It doesn't have to be about humans against Parshmen. It can be nobler than that. Oppressed against the oppressors."
As they passed the place where Syl was, Kaladin swept his hand along the wall. Syl, as they'd practiced, zipped up the sleeve of his coat. He could feel her, like a gust of wind, move up his sleeve, then out his collar, into his hair. The long curls hid her, they'd determined, well enough.
"There are a lot of those yellow-white spren here, Kaladin," she whispered, "zipping through the air, dancing through buildings."
"Any signs of humans?" Kaladin whispered.
"To the east," she said, "crammed into some army barracks and old Parshmen quarters. Others are in big pens, watched under guard. Kaladin, there's another high storm coming today."
"When?"
"Soon, maybe. I'm new to guessing this. I doubt anyone is expecting it. Everything has been thrown off. The charts will all be wrong until people can make new ones."
Kaladin hissed slowly through his teeth. Ahead, his team approached a large group of Parshmen. Judging by the way they'd been organized into large lines, this was some kind of processing station for new arrivals. Indeed, Hen's band of 100 was shuffled into one of the lines to wait. Ahead of them, a Parshman in full carapace armor, like a Parshendi, strolled down the line holding a writing board. Syl pulled farther into Kaladin's hair as the Parshendi man stepped up to Hen's group.
"What towns, work camps, or armies do you all come from?"
His voice had a strange cadence, similar to the Parshendi Kaladin had heard on the Shattered Plains. Some of those in Hen's group had hints of it, but nothing this strong. The scribe Parshman wrote down the list of towns Hen gave him, then noted their spears.
"You've been busy. I'll recommend you for special training. Send your captive to the pens. I'll write down a description here, and once you're settled, you can put him to work."
"He," Ken said, looking at Kaladin. "He is not our captive."
She seemed begrudging.
"He was one of the humans' slaves, like us. He wishes to join and fight."
The Parshman looked up in the air at nothing.
"Yixli is speaking for you," Saw whispered to Kaladin. "She sounds impressed."
"Well," the scribe said, "it's not unheard of, but you'll have to get permission from one of the fused to label him free."
"One of the what?" Hen asked.
The Parshman with the writing board pointed toward his left. Kaladin had to step out of the line, along with several of the others, to see a tall Parshwoman with long hair. There was carapace covering her cheeks, running back along the cheekbones and into her hair. The skin on her arms prickled with ridges, as if there were carapace under the skin as well. Her eyes glowed red. Kaladin's breath caught. Bridge 4 had described these creatures to him, the strange Parshendi they'd fought during their push toward the center of the Shattered Plains. These were the beings who had summoned the Everstorm. This one focused directly on Kaladin.
There was something oppressive about her red gaze. Kaladin heard a clap of thunder in the far distance. Around him, many of the Parshmen turned toward it and began to mutter. High storm. In that moment, Kaladin made his decision. He'd stayed with Saw and the others as long as he dared. He'd learned what he could. The storm presented a chance. It's time to go. The tall, dangerous creature with the red eyes, the Fused, they had called her, began walking toward Hen's group. Kaladin couldn't know if she recognized him as a Radiant, but he had no intention of waiting until she arrived. He'd been planning. The old slave's instincts had already decided upon the easiest way out. It was on Hen's belt. Kaladin sucked in the stormlight right from her pouch. He burst a light with its power, then grabbed the pouch. He needed those gemstones and yanked it free, the leather straps snapping. "Get your people to shelter," Kaladin said to the surprised Hen. "A high storm is close. Thank you for your kindness. No matter what you are told, know this. I do not wish to be your enemy." The Fused began to scream with an angry voice. Kaladin met Saw's betrayed expression, then launched himself into the air. Freedom. Kaladin's skin shivered with joy. Storms, how he'd missed this. The wind, the openness above, even the lurch in his stomach as gravity let go. Syl spun around him as a ribbon of light, creating a spiral of glowing lines. Glory Spren burst upon Kaladin's head. Syl took on the form of a person just so she could glower at the little bobbing balls of light. "Mine," she said, swatting one of them aside. About 500 or 600 feet up, Kaladin changed to a half-lashing, so he slowed and hovered in the sky. Beneath, that red-eyed Parshwoman was gesturing and screaming, though Kaladin couldn't hear her. Storms. He hoped this wouldn't mean trouble for Saw and the others. He had an excellent view of the city, the streets filled with figures now making for shelter in buildings. Other groups rushed to the city from all directions. Even after spending so much time with them, his first reaction was one of discomfort. So many Parshmen together in one place? It was unnatural. This impression bothered him now as it never would have before. He eyed the storm wall, which he could see approaching in the far distance. He still had time before it arrived. He'd have to fly up above the storm to avoid being caught in its winds. But then what? "Urethiru is out there somewhere to the west," Kaladin said. "Can you guide us there?"
"How would I do that?"
"You've been there before."
"So have you."
"You're a force of nature, Syl," Kaladin said. "You can feel the storms. Don't you have some kind of location sense?"
"You're the one from this realm," she said, batting away another glory spren and hanging in the air beside him, folding her arms. "Besides, I'm less a force of nature and more one of the raw powers of creation transformed by collective human imagination into a personification of one of their ideals."
She grinned at him.
"Where did you come up with that?" "Dunno. Maybe I heard it somewhere once. Or maybe I'm just smart."
"We'll have to make for the Shattered Plains, then," Kaladin said. "We can strike out for one of the larger cities in southern Alethkar, swap gemstones there, and hopefully have enough to hop over to the war camps." That decided, he tied his gemstone pouch to his belt, then glanced down and tried to make a final estimate of troop numbers and Parshmen fortifications. It felt odd to not worry about the storm, but he'd just move up over it once it arrived. From up here, Kaladin could see the great trenches cut into the stones to divert away floodwaters after a storm. Though most of the Parshmen had fled for shelter, some remained below, craning necks and staring up at him. He read betrayal in their postures, though he couldn't even tell if these were members of Hen's group or not.
"What?"
Syl asked, alighting on his shoulder. "I can't help but feel a kinship to them, Syl."
"They conquered the city. They're void bringers."
"No, they're people. And they're angry. With good reason." A gust of wind blew across him, making him drift to the side. "I know that feeling. It burns in you, worms inside your brain until you forget everything but the injustice done to you. It's how I felt about Elakar.
Sometimes a world of rational explanations can become meaningless in the face of that all-consuming desire to get what you deserve.
You changed your mind about Elokar, Kaladin. You saw what was right.
Did I? Did I find what was right? Or did I just finally agree to see things the way you wanted?
Killing Elokar was wrong.
And the parchment on the shattered plains that I killed, murdering them wasn't wrong?
You were protecting Dalinar.
Who was assaulting their homeland.
Because they killed his brother.
Which, for all we know, they did because they saw how King Gavilar and his people treated the parchmen.
Kaladin turned toward Syl, who sat on his shoulder, one leg tucked beneath her.
So what's the difference, Syl? What is the difference between Dalinar attacking the parchmen and these parchmen conquering that city?
I don't know,
she said softly.
And why was it worse for me to let Elokar be killed for his injustices than it was for me to actively kill Parshman on the Shattered Plains?
One is wrong. I mean, it just feels wrong. Both do, I guess.
Except one nearly broke my bond, while the other didn't. The bond isn't about what's right and wrong, is it, Syl? It's about what you see as right and wrong.
What we see, she corrected. And about oaths. You swore to protect Elokar. Tell me that during your time planning to betray Elokar, you didn't, deep down, think you were doing something wrong.
Fine. But it's still about perception.
Kaladin let the winds blow him, feeling a pit open in his belly.
Storms. I'd hoped you could tell me. Give me an absolute right. For once, I'd like my moral code not to come with a list of exceptions at the end.
She nodded thoughtfully.
I'd have expected you to object, Kaladin said. You're a... what? Embodiment of human perceptions of honor? Shouldn't you at least think you have all the answers?
Probably, she said. Or maybe if there are answers, I should be the one who wants to find them.
The storm wall was now fully visible, the great wall of water and refuse, pushed by the oncoming winds of a high storm. Kaladin had drifted along with the winds away from the city, so he lashed himself eastward until they floated over the hills that made up the city's windbreak. Here he spotted something he hadn't seen earlier. Pens full of great masses of humans. The winds blowing in from the east were growing stronger. However, the parchmen guarding the pens were just standing there, as if nobody had given them orders to move. The first rumblings of the high storm had been distant, easy to miss. They'd notice it soon, but that might be too late.
Oh, Syl said. Kaladin, those people.
Kaladin cursed, then dropped the lashing holding him upward, which made him fall in a rush. He crashed to the ground, sending out a puff of glowing stormlight that expanded from him in a ring.
High storm, he shouted at the parchmen guards. High storm coming! Get these people to safety!
They looked at him, dumbfounded. Not a surprising reaction. Kaladin summoned his blade, shoving past the parchmen and leaping up onto the pen's low stone wall, for keeping hogs. He held aloft the Syl blade. Townspeople swarmed to the wall. Cries of Shardbearer rose.
A high storm is coming,
he shouted, but his voice was quickly lost in the tumult of voices. Storms. He had little doubt that the Voidbringers could handle a group of rioting townsfolk. He sucked in more stormlight, raising himself into the air. That quieted them, even drove them backward.
Where did you shelter? He demanded in a loud voice. When the last storms came.
A few people near the front pointed at the large bunkers nearby, for housing livestock, parchmen, and even travelers during storms. Could those hold an entire town's worth of people? Maybe, if they crowded in.
Get moving, Kaladin said. A storm will be here soon.
Kaladin,
Syl's voice said in his mind.
Behind you.
He turned and found parchmen guards approaching his wall with spears. Kaladin hopped down as the townspeople finally reacted, climbing the walls, which were barely chest-high and slathered with smooth, hardened creme. Kaladin took one step toward the parchmen,
then swiped his blade, separating their spearheads from the hafts. The Parshman, who had barely more training than the ones he'd traveled with, stepped back in confusion.
"Do you want to fight me?" Kaladin asked them.
One shook her head.
"Then see that those people don't trample each other in their haste to get to safety," Kaladin said, pointing. "And keep the rest of the guards from attacking them. This isn't a revolt. Can't you hear the thunder and feel the wind picking up?"
He launched himself onto the wall again, then waved for the people to move, shouting orders. The Parshman guards eventually decided that instead of fighting a shardbearer, they'd risk getting into trouble for doing what he said. Before too long, he had an entire team of them prodding the humans, often less gently than he'd have liked, toward the storm bunkers. Kaladin dropped down beside one of the guards, a female whose spear he'd sliced in half.
"How did this work the last time the storm hit?"
"We mostly left the humans to themselves," she admitted. "We were too busy running for safety."
So the Voidbringers hadn't anticipated that storm's arrival either. Kaladin winced, trying not to dwell on how many people had likely been lost to the impact of the storm wall.
"Do better," he said to her. "These people are your charge now. You've seized the city, taken what you want. If you wish to claim any kind of moral superiority, treat your captives better than they did you."
"Look,"
the Parsh woman said.
"Who are you? And why—"
Something large crashed into Kaladin, tossing him backward into the wall with a crunch. The thing had arms. A person who grasped for his throat, trying to strangle him. He kicked them off. Their eyes trailed red. A blackish, violet glow, like dark stormlight, rose from the red-eyed Parshman. Kaladin cursed and lashed himself into the air. The creature followed. Another rose nearby, leaving a faint violet glow behind, flying as easily as he did. These two looked different from the one he'd seen earlier, leaner, with longer hair. Syl cried out in his mind, a sound like pain and surprise mixed. He could only assume that someone had run to fetch these after he had taken to the sky. A few wind sprens zipped past Kaladin, then began to dance playfully around him. The sky grew dark, the storm wall thundering across the land. Those red-eyed Parshendi chased him upward, so Kaladin lashed himself straight toward the storm. It had worked against the assassin in white. The high storm was dangerous, but it was also something of an ally. The two creatures followed, though they overshot his elevation and had to lash themselves back downward in a weird bobbing motion. That reminded him of his first experimentation with his powers. Kaladin braced himself, holding to the Syl blade, joined by four or five windspren, and crashed through the storm wall. An unstable darkness swallowed him, a darkness that was often split by lightning and broken by phantom glows. Winds contorted and clashed like rival armies, so irregular that Kaladin was tossed by them one way, then the other. It took all his skill in lashing to simply get going in the right direction. He watched over his shoulder as the two red-eyed Parshmen burst in. Their strange glow was more subdued than his own, and somehow gave off the impression of an anti-glow, a darkness that clung to them. They were immediately disrupted, sent spinning in the wind. Kaladin smiled, then was nearly crushed by a boulder tumbling through the air. Sheer luck saved him. The boulder passed close enough that another few inches would have ripped off his arm. Kaladin lashed himself upward, soaring through the tempest toward its ceiling.
"Stormfather!" he yelled. "Spren of storms!"
No response.
"Turn yourself aside!" Kaladin shouted into the churning winds. "There are people below! Stormfather! You must listen to me!"
All grew still. Kaladin stood in that strange space where he'd seen the Stormfather before, a place that seemed outside of reality. The ground was far beneath him, dim, slicked with rain, but barren and empty. Kaladin hovered in the air, not lashed. The air was simply solid beneath him.
"Who are you to make demands of the storm, son of honor?"
The Stormfather was a face as wide as the sky, dominating like a sunrise. Kaladin held his sword aloft.
"I know you for what you are, Stormfather. A Spren, like Syl."
"I am the memory of a god,
the fragment that remains, the soul of a storm and the mind of eternity.
Then surely with that soul, mind, and memory, Kaladin said, you can find mercy for the people below.
And what of the hundreds of thousands who have died in these winds before? Should I have had mercy for them?
Yes.
And the waves that swallow, the fires that consume, you would have them stop?
I speak only of you, and only today. Please.
Thunder rumbled, and the Stormfather actually seemed to consider the request.
It is not something I can do, son of Tanavast. If the wind stops blowing, it is not a wind. It is nothing.
But...
Kaladin dropped back into the tempest proper, and it seemed as if no time had passed. He ducked through the winds, gritting his teeth in frustration. Windspren accompanied him. He had 24 now, a spinning and laughing group, each a ribbon of light. He passed one of the glowing-eyed parshmen. The fused? Did that term refer to all whose eyes glowed? The Stormfather really could be more helpful, Syl. Didn't he claim to be your father?
It's complicated, she said in his mind. He's stubborn, though. I'm sorry.
He's callous, Kaladin said.
He's a storm, Kaladin, as people over millennia have imagined him.
He could choose.
Perhaps, perhaps not. I think what you're doing is like asking fire to please stop being so hot.
Kaladin zoomed down along the ground, quickly reaching the hills around Revelar. He had hoped to find that everyone was safe, but that was, of course, a frail hope. People were scattered across the pens and the ground near the bunkers. One of those bunkers still had the doors open, and a few men were trying, bless them, to gather the last people outside and carry them in. Many were too far away. They huddled against the ground, holding to the wall or outcroppings of rock. Kaladin could barely make them out in the flashes of lightning, terrified lumps alone in the tempest. He had felt those winds. He'd been powerless before them, tied to the side of a building.
Kaladin,
Syl said in his mind as he dropped. The storm pulsed inside him. Within the high storm, his stormlight constantly renewed. It preserved him, had saved his life 12 times over. That very power that had tried to kill him had been his salvation. He hit the ground and dropped Syl, then seized the form of a young father clutching a son. He pulled them up, holding them secure, trying to run them toward the building. Nearby, another person, he couldn't see much of them, was torn away in a gust of wind and taken by the darkness.
Kaladin, you can't save them all.
He screamed as he grabbed another person, holding her tight and walking with them. They stumbled in the wind as they reached a cluster of people huddled together, some 24 or more in the shadow of the wall around the pens. Kaladin pulled the three he was helping, the father, the child, the woman, over to the others.
You can't stay out here, he shouted at them all. Together! You have to walk together! This way!
With effort, winds howling, rain pelting like daggers, he got the group moving across the stony ground arm in arm. They made good progress until a boulder crunched to the ground nearby, sending some of them huddling down in a panic. The wind rose, lifting some people up. Only the clutching hands of the others kept them from blowing away. Kaladin blinked away tears that mingled with the rain. He bellowed. Nearby, a flash of light illuminated a man being crushed as a portion of wall ripped away and towed his body off into the storm.
Kaladin, Syl said, I'm sorry.
Being sorry isn't enough, he yelled.
He clung with one arm to a child, his face toward the storm and its terrible winds. Why did it destroy? This tempest shaped them. Must it ruin them, too? Consumed by his pain and feelings of betrayal, Kaladin surged with stormlight and flung his hand forward as if to try to push back the wind itself. 100 windspren spun in as lines of light, twisting around his arm, wrapping it like ribbons. They surged with light, then exploded outward in a blinding sheet, sweeping to Kaladin's sides and parting the winds around him. Kaladin stood with his hand toward the tempest and deflected it.
Like a stone in a swift-moving river stopped the waters, he opened a pocket in the storm, creating a calm wake behind him. The storm raged against him, but he held the point in a formation of windspren that spread from him like wings, diverting the storm. He managed to turn his head as the storm battered him. People huddled behind him, soaked, confused, surrounded by calm.
"Go!"
he shouted.
"Go!"
They found their feet, the young father taking his son back from Kaladin's leeward arm. Kaladin backed up with them, maintaining the windbreak. This group was only some of those trapped by the winds, yet it took everything Kaladin had to hold the tempest. The winds seemed angry at him for his defiance. All it would take was one boulder. A figure with glowing red eyes landed on the field before him. It advanced, but the people had finally reached the bunker. Kaladin sighed and released the winds, and the spren behind him scattered. Exhausted, he let the storm pick him up and fling him away. A quick lashing gave him elevation, preventing him from being rammed into the buildings of the city.
"Wow,"
Syl said in his mind.
"What did you just do with the storm?"
"Not enough," Kaladin whispered.
"You'll never be able to do enough to satisfy yourself, Kaladin. That was still wonderful."
He was past Revelar in a heartbeat. He turned, becoming merely another piece of debris on the winds. The fused gave chase, but lagged behind, then vanished. Kaladin and Syl pushed out of the storm wall, then rode it at the front of the storm. They passed over cities, plains, mountains, never running out of stormlight, for there was a source renewing them from behind. They flew for a good hour like that before a current in the winds nudged him toward the south.
"Go that way,"
Syl said, a ribbon of light.
"Why?" "Just listen to the peace of nature incarnate, okay? I think Father wants to apologize in his own way."
Kaladin growled, but allowed the winds to channel him in a specific direction. He flew this way for hours, lost in the sounds of the tempest, until finally he settled down, half of his own volition, half because of the pressing winds. The storm passed, leaving him in the middle of a large, open field of rock. The plateau in front of the tower city of Urethiru.
32. Company. For I, of all people, have changed. From Oathbringer, Preface. Shallan settled in Sabariel's sitting room. It was a strangely shaped stone chamber with a loft above. He sometimes put musicians there, and a shallow cavity in the floor, which he kept saying he was going to fill with water and fish. She was fairly certain he made claims like that just to annoy Dalinar with his supposed extravagance. For now, they'd covered the hole with some boards, and Sabariel would periodically warn people not to step on them. The rest of the room was decorated lavishly. She was pretty sure she'd seen those tapestries in a monastery in Dalinar's war camp, and they were matched by luxurious furniture, golden lamps, and ceramics, and a bunch of splintery boards covering a pit. She shook her head. Then, curled up on a sofa with blankets heaped over her, she gladly accepted a cup of steaming citrus tea from Polona. She still hadn't been able to rid herself of the lingering chill she'd felt since her encounter with Ray Shafir a few hours back.
"Is there anything else I can get you?" Polona asked.
Shallan shook her head, so the Herdazian woman settled herself on a sofa nearby, holding another cup of tea. Shallan sipped, glad for the company. Adolin had wanted her to sleep, but the last thing she wanted was to be alone. He'd handed her over to Polona's care, then stayed with Dalinar and Navani to answer their further questions.
"So," Polona said, "what was it like?"
How to answer that? She'd touched the storming Midnight Mother, a name from ancient lore, one of the unmade, princes of the Voidbringers. People sang about Ray Shafir in poetry and epics, describing her as a dark, beautiful figure.
Paintings depicted her as a black-clad woman with red eyes and a sultry gaze. That seemed to exemplify how little they really remembered about these things.
"It wasn't like the stories," Shallan whispered. "Ray Shafir is a Spren. A vast, terrible Spren who wants so desperately to understand us. So she kills us, imitating our violence."
There was a deeper mystery beyond that. A wisp of something she'd glimpsed while intertwined with Ray Shafir. It made Shallan wonder if this Spren wasn't merely trying to understand humankind, but rather searching for something it itself had lost. Had this creature, in distant, distant time beyond memory, once been human? They didn't know. They didn't know anything. At Shallan's first report, Navani had set her scholars searching for information, but their access to books here was still limited. Even with access to the Palinaeum, Shallan wasn't optimistic. Yasna had hunted for years to find Urithiru, and even then most of what she'd discovered had been unreliable. It had simply been too many years. "To think it was here all this time," Pallona said, "hiding down there."
"She was captive," Shallan whispered. "She eventually escaped, but that was centuries ago. She has been waiting here ever since."
"Well, we should find where the others are held and make sure they don't get out."
"I don't know if the others were ever captured." She'd felt isolation and loneliness from Ray Shafir, a sense of being torn away while the others escaped.
"So they're out there, and always have been," Shallan said.
She felt exhausted, and her eyes were drooping in direct defiance of her insistence to Adolin that she was not that kind of tired.
"Surely we'd have discovered them by now."
"I don't know," Shallan said. They'll just be normal to us, the way things have always been."
She yawned, then nodded absently as Pallona continued talking, her comments degenerating into praise of Shallan for acting as she had. Adolin had been the same way, which she hadn't minded, and Alinar had been downright nice to her, instead of being his usual stern rock of a human being. She didn't tell them how near she'd come to breaking, and how terrified she was that she might someday meet that creature again. But maybe she did deserve some acclaim. She'd been a child when she'd left her home, seeking salvation for her family. For the first time since that day on the ship, watching Yarkaved fade behind her, she felt like she actually might have a handle on all of this, like she might have found some stability in her life, some control over herself and her surroundings. Remarkably, she kind of felt like an adult. She smiled and snuggled into her blankets, drinking her tea and, for the moment, putting out of her mind that basically an entire troop of soldiers had seen her with her glove off. She was kind of an adult. She could deal with a little embarrassment. In fact, she was increasingly certain that between Shallan, Vale, and Radiant, she could deal with anything life could throw at her. A disturbance outside made her sit up, though it didn't sound dangerous. Some chatter, a few boisterous exclamations. She wasn't terribly surprised when Adolin stepped in, bowed to Pallona. He did have nice manners, and jogged over to her, his uniform still rumpled from having worn shard plate over it.
"Don't panic," he said. "It's a good thing."
"It?" she said, growing alarmed.
"Well, someone just arrived at the tower."
"Oh, that. Sabariel passed the news. The bridge boy's back."
"Him?" "No, that's not what I'm talking about."
Adolin searched for words as voices approached, and several other people stepped into the room. At their head was Yasna Kolin. The end of part one.
Interludes. Puli, Elista, Benley. Interlude 1. Puli.
Puli, the lighthouse keeper, tried not to let everyone know how excited he was for this new storm. It was truly tragic. Truly tragic. He told Sokkan this as she wept. She had thought herself quite high and blessed when she'd landed her new husband. She'd moved into the man's fine stone hut in a prime spot for growing a garden behind the northern cliffs of the town. Puli gathered scraps of wood blown eastward by the strange storm and piled them in his little cart. He pulled it with two hands, leaving Sokkan to weep for her husband. Up to three now, she was, all lost at sea. Truly tragic. Still, he was excited for the storm. He pulled his cart past other broken homes here, where they should have been sheltered west of the cliffs. Puli's grandfather had been able to remember when those cliffs hadn't been there. Kalek himself had broken apart the land in the middle of a storm, making a new prime spot for homes. Where would the rich people put their houses now? And they did have rich people here in town, never mind what the travelers on the ocean said. Those would stop at this little port on the crumbling eastern edge of Roshar and shelter from storms in their cove alongside the cliffs. Puli pulled his cart past the cove. Here, one of the foreigner captains, with long eyebrows and tan skin, rather than the proper blue skin, was trying to make sense of her ruined ship. It had been rocked in the cove, struck by lightning, then smashed back against the stones. Now only the mast was visible. Truly tragic, Puli said. He complimented the captain on the mast, though. It was a very nice mast. Puli picked up a few planks from the broken ship that had washed onto the shore of the cove, then threw them into his cart. Even if it had destroyed many a ship, Puli was happy for this new storm. Secretly happy. Had the time finally come that his grandfather had warned of? The time of changes? When the men from the hidden island of the origin at last came to reclaim Natanatan? Even if not, this new storm brought him so much wood. Scraps of rock buds, branches from trees. He gathered it all eagerly, piling his cart high, then pulled it past fissures and huddles, trying to decide how they'd survive in a world with storms from both directions. Fishers didn't sleep away the weeping like lazy farmers. They worked it, for there were no winds. Lots of bailing, but no winds. Until now. A tragedy, he told Aulam, while helping him clear the refuse of his barn. Many of the boards ended up in Puli's cart. A tragedy, he agreed with Himadak as he watched her children so she could run a broth to her sister, who was sick with the fever. A tragedy, he told the Drummer brothers, as he helped them pull a tattered sail from the surf and stretch it out on the rocks. At last Puli finished his rounds and pulled his little cart up the long, twisting road toward Defiance. That was his name for the lighthouse. Nobody else called it that, because to them it was just the lighthouse. At the top he left out an offering of fruit for Kalek, the herald who lived in the storm. Then he pulled his wagon into the room on the bottom floor. Defiance wasn't a tall lighthouse. He'd seen paintings of the sleek, fashionable ones down along Longbrow's Straits. Lighthouses for rich folks who sailed ships that didn't catch fish. Defiance was only 2 stories tall and built squat like a bunker. But she had good stonework and a buffer of creme on the outside kept her from leaking. She'd stood for over 100 years, and Kalek hadn't decided to knock her down. The Stormfather knew how important she was. Puli carried a load of wet stormwood and broken boards up to the top of the lighthouse, where he set them out beside the fire, which burned low during the day, to dry. He dusted off his hands, then stepped up to the rim of the lighthouse. At night, the mirrors would shine the light right out through this hole. He looked over the cliffs to the east. His family was a lot like the lighthouse themselves, squat, short, but powerful. And enduring.
"They'll come with light in their pockets," Grandfather had said. He'll come to destroy. But you should watch for them anyway, because they'll come from the origin. The sailors lost on an infinite sea. You keep that fire high at night, Puli. You burn it bright until the day they come. They'll arrive when the night is darkest.
Surely that was now, with a new storm. Darkest nights, a tragedy, and a sign.
Interlude 2. Elista. The Yokasha Monastery was ordinarily a very quiet place. Nestled in the forests on the western slopes of the Horneater Peaks, the monastery felt only rain at the passing of a high storm. Furious rain, yes, but none of the terrible violence known in most parts of the world. Elista reminded herself every passing storm how lucky she was. Some Ardents had fought half their lives to be transferred to Yokasha. Away from politics, storms, and other annoyances, at Yokasha you could simply think. Usually.
Are you looking at these numbers? Are your eyes disconnected from your brain? We can't judge yet. 3 instances are not enough. 2 data points to make a coincidence, 3 to make a sequence. The Everstorm travels at a consistent speed, unlike the High Storm. You can't possibly say that. One of your data points, so highly touted, is from the original passing of the storm, which happened as an uncommon event.
Elista slammed her book closed and stuffed it into her satchel. She burst from her reading nook and gave a glare to the 2 Ardents arguing in the hall outside, both wearing the caps of master scholars. They were so involved in their shouting match that they didn't even respond to the glare, though it had been one of her best. She bustled from the library, entering a long hallway with sides open to the elements. Peaceful trees, a quiet brook, humid air and mossy vines that popped and stretched as they lay out for the evening. Well, yes, a large swath of trees out there had been flattened by the new storm, but that was no reason for everyone to get upset. The rest of the world could worry. Here, at the central home of the Devotary of the Mind, she was supposed to be able to just read. She set her things out at a reading desk near an open window. The humidity wasn't good for books, but weak storms went hand in hand with fecundity. You simply had to accept that. Hopefully those new fabrials to draw water from the air would...
Telling you we're going to have to move!
A new voice echoed through the hallway. Look, the storm is going to ravage those woods. Before long this slope will be barren, and the storm will be hitting us full force.
The new storm doesn't have that strong a wind factor, Betum. It's not going to blow down the trees. Have you looked at my measurements?
I've disputed those measurements.
But...
Elista rubbed her temples. She wore her head shaved, like the other Ardents. Her parents still joked that she'd joined the Ardentia simply because she hated bothering with her hair. She tried earplugs but could hear the arguing through them, so she packed up her things again. Maybe the low building? She took the long set of steps outside, traveling down the slope along a forested path. Before arriving at the monastery for the first time, she'd had illusions about what it would be like to live among scholars. No bickering, no politicking. She hadn't found that to be true, but generally people left her alone, and so she was lucky to be here. She told herself that again as she entered the lower building.
It was basically a zoo. Dozens of people gathering information from span reeds, talking to one another, buzzing with talk of this or that high prince or king.
She stopped in the doorway, took it all in for a moment, then turned on her heel and stalked back out.
Now what?
She started back up the steps, but slowed.
It's probably the only route to peace, she thought, looking out into the forest.
Trying not to think about the dirt, the Kremlings, and the fact that something might drip on her head, she strode off into the forest. She didn't want to go too far, as who knew what might be out here? She chose a stump without too much moss on it, and settled down among bobbing lifespren, book across her lap. She could still hear Arden's arguing, but they were distant. She opened her book, intent on finally getting something done today. Weema spun away from Brightlord Sterling's forward advances, tucking her safe hand to her breast and lowering her gaze from his comely locks. Such affection as to excite the unsavory mind could surely not satisfy her for an extended period, as though his attentions had at one time been fanciful delights to entertain her leisure hours. They now seemed to manifest his utmost impudence and greatest faults of character. "What?" Elista exclaimed, reading. "No, you silly girl. He's finally pronounced his affection for you. Don't you dare turn away now." How could she accept this wanton justification of her once single-minded desires? Should she not, instead, select the more prudent choice, as advocated by the undeviating will of her uncle? Bright Lord Vadam had an endowment of land upon the High Prince's grace, and would have means to provide far beyond the satisfactions available to a simple officer, no matter how well regarded, or what winds had graced his temperaments, features, and gentle touch. Elista gasped. "Bright Lord Vadam? You little whore! Have you forgotten how he locked away your father?"
"Weema," Bright Lord Sterling intoned, "it seems I have gravely misjudged your attentions. In this I find myself deposited deep within an embarrassment of folly. I shall be away, to the shattered plains, and you shall not again suffer the torment of my presence."
He bowed a true gentleman's bow, possessed of all proper refinement and deference. It was a supplication beyond what even a monarch could rightly demand, and in it Weema ascertained the true nature of Brightlord Sterling's regard. Simple, yet passionate, respectful indeed. It lent great context to his earlier advance, which now appeared all at once to be a righteous division in otherwise sure armor, a window of vulnerability rather than a model of avarice. As he lifted the door's latch to forever make his exodus from her life, Weema surged with unrivaled shame and longing, twisted together not unlike two threads winding in a loom to construct a grand tapestry of desire. "Wait," Weema cried. "Dear Sterling, wait upon my words."
"Storm's right, you'd better wait, Sterling."
Elista leaned closer to the book, flipping the page. Decorum seemed a vain thing to her now, lost upon the sea that was her need to feel Sterling's touch. She rushed to him, and upon his arm pressed her ensleeved hand, which she then lifted to caress his sturdy jaw. It was so warm out here in the forest, practically sweltering. Elista put her hand to her lips, reading with wide eyes, trembling. "Would that the window through that statuesque armor could still be located, and that a similar wound within herself might be found, to press against his own and offer passage deep within her soul. If only..."
"Elista?" a voice asked.
"Yip," she said, bolting upright, snapping the book closed, and spun toward the sound. Oh, Ardent Irv." The young Siln Ardent was tall, gangly, and obnoxiously loud at times, except apparently when sneaking up on colleagues in the forest.
"What was that you were studying?" he asked.
"Important works," Elista said, then sat on the book. "Nothing to mind yourself with. What is it you want?" He looked down at her satchel.
"You were the last one to check out the transcriptions from Benthel's collected Dawnchant? The old versions?"
I just wanted to check on your progress.
Dawn chant. Right. They'd been working on that before this storm came and everyone got distracted. Old Navani Kolin in Alethkar had somehow cracked the Dawn chant. Her story about visions was nonsense. The Kolin family was known for opaque politics. But her key was authentic, and had let them slowly work through the old texts. Elista started digging in her satchel. She came up with 3 musty codices and a sheaf of papers, the latter being the work she'd done so far. Annoyingly, Irv settled on the ground beside her stump, taking the papers as she offered them. He laid his satchel across his lap and began reading.
"Incredible," he said a few moments later. "You've made more progress than I have."
"Everyone else is too busy worrying about that storm."
"Well, it is threatening to wipe out civilization."
"An overreaction. Everyone always overreacts to every little gust of wind."
He flipped through her pages. "What's this section? Why take such care for where each text was found?"